Listen to the Carpcast on iTunes and subscribe through the podcast app on your iPhone or iPad. For Android users, find us on the Stitcher Radio app. Go to Google Play and download Stitcher Radio for podcasts. Add us to your playlist and click listen to hear us anytime you like. Don't forget to enable offline listening if you wish to save your data on the bank. We're also available on the SoundCloud app under the Carpcast, or check our website at www.thecarpcast.com. Remember, listening through an app will recall where you were up to when you get that screamer, or you could always make a whip. The fish, of course. To the Carpcast, introducing the two biggest nods that don't use chops. They're old, grumpy, and they're pretty opinionated. Here's your hosts, it's Mark and Jamie.
So hello and welcome to episode 42 of the Carpcast. We're a good 40 now. No scrapers anymore. We're starting to get up there, aren't we?
We are. We're moving the needle.
Yeah. Getting it round. We've accounted for the sling. Just about.
Yeah, we don't have to stand on the sling this time.
What you been up to? You been fishing?
I had my first two-night session of the year this weekend, and I caught one fish.
Yeah?
It was a big, dirty bream.
Wow. Quite a few places have kicked off this week, I've noticed, over the last few days. There's been plenty going on. Not managed to get out myself. Played a poker tournament at the weekend. Came close, but no cigar, to winning loads of money. It's pretty much the story of this year. So you caught a bream, and
it was a big bream. I'll be honest, when you fish places like, you know, a lot of these carp places, and you know the bream get on the boilies, they grow, and you know the records bream who I've been fishing is just under 17 pound, and I didn't weigh the one I had. I just unhooked it in the water and let it go to swim and let the lads who fish for him enjoy them. But I'm guessing it was about 13 or 14. It was a damn big bream, an impressive fish, if I'm very honest.
A clonker of a bream, yeah. Cool. Well,
still not a carp.
It was full moon this week, as you may or may not have known. I seen a few interesting threads, but you know what they say on a full moon, don't you? It's a big commons. I'm sure you've heard that.
I've heard that, but big commons can be caught any time, not just a full moon. I don't believe the phenomenon. I'm sceptical, to say the least.
Okay, well, I guess you haven't seen Sean Harrison's thread over the last few days, then.
It's on the net. It must be true.
I haven't, no. What's he got to say?
Quite a lot about the moon. First of all, I've noticed a lot of large commons come out in the last 2 days. We're recording this on Friday. You're going to hear it Saturday tea time, probably, evening. Dinner time for you southerners. We're on the last day of the 3 days kind of peak period of the full moon, and I have noticed, before I even knew it was a full moon, I'd noticed a lot of big commons coming out, including Terry Dempsey's caught a very large one. I've seen a good half a dozen big commons caught. Then I noticed a thread Sean Harrison had commented on. Some guy had made a post. I should find his name now, actually. He'd made a post basically saying, come on then, guys, you know, full moon, big commons, what's it about, you know, tell me. Which started a really long and interesting debate. We should have the It's on the Net jingle here, actually.
It started a debate,
and Sean Harrison chirped in, obviously a long time angler, nearly 40 years he's been carping now, well-respected guy. He chirped in, basically saying he's been keeping records for a hell of a long time in relation to the moon, and he's absolutely certain about it. Well, I noticed it with my own eyes this week. Obviously, there's people debating back and forwards, almost like witchcraft, you know, a bit like you've said, believers, non-believers. I personally have witnessed it many times. I do believe commons act differently to the normal king mirror carp. I do believe they act different in lots of ways, from, you know, tastes to habits. Yes, I've caught many commons not on full moons, but I've also had quite a few big commons myself, so I feel kind of qualified to talk about this. You know, I've had three different £48 plus English commons. Brag, thank you.
Round of applause.
We need a round of applause jingle, don't we? But I couldn't actually tell you if they were on full moons. I'll have to go back through my Facebook to find out when I've caught these fish and have a look compare it to the moon. But Sean basically has done, and he's so sure of his findings he doesn't want to publish them. He'll discuss it in general terms. He won't discuss it in great detail. Anyway, I have secured him. I hope to have had him on the Carpcast this week. He's had a nightmare with his computer at his shop, and he's spending all day in there, somebody trying to fix his hard drive for him. So otherwise he would have been on the show this week, but he has promised to come on, and we will pick his brain about the moon and many other things. As a long time respected angler, always worked in the angling trade, I think he'll make a great guest. He's exactly the sort of person we're looking for. So yes, maybe next week we will have him on. But yep, I think maybe we should postpone this conversation till then. We spoke about the moon a lot in the past, but the full moon and the commons is a bit deeper than the normal new moon. Even you can't deny the new moon big fish thing, can you, Mark?
I don't know. Because I like to look at things from a scientific point of view, and what is the connection between the moon and a fish eating one of our baits and getting caught?
But you have noticed a pattern, though, haven't you? I mean, take Mr. Angry, who lives in Manchester Park Lake. I think the previous 8 of the previous 9 captures have been on a new moon. And that's spanning over 10 years. I mean, you know, Stoneacres, it'll throw up 3 weeks of the month, it'll throw up maybe 5 fish, and it'll do 15 fish on New Moon Week every single month.
I mean, yeah, but is there other factors involved in that? Is the weather that coincides with the New Moon, that wind moves the water?
Yeah, well, we've said this before. I mean, obviously, the new moon brings low pressure and carp feed in low pressure, right? So what has caused the carp to feed?
Yeah, well, the low new pressure moon. is indirectly, but the direct influence on the carp is what moves the water, what changes the temperature of the medium that they live in.
Yeah, and what changes that temperature? The new moon. So do carp feed more on a new moon? Yes. Because the new moon, it doesn't matter why.
The new moon is like 3 or 4 steps back in the chain.
Well, yeah, but
the action.
It's the cause. If you ask to answer the question, we're not asking do carp feed on good weather. We're not asking that question. We're asking, do more carp get caught on a new moon? Yes or no? I would say yes. The fact is, if you go down the line and go, well, why is that? Well, because a new moon makes a gravitational pull, it drops the air pressure, carp like low air pressure, blah, 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 go on and go on. But, you know, more carp get caught on a new moon than any other moon. Especially the big ones seem to feed on a new moon. Whether it's because they're all just feeding harder and the big ones slip up. Because obviously all fish are feeding every day. There's not a day past when the fish aren't feeding. So if you're extremely cute and you've got some super duper rig that they've literally got a sneeze near it and it snags them, then you're going to catch more than everybody else. But you're going to catch fish at other times. You know, Ziggs have done that as well. They've snagged fish at times where they probably weren't feeding hard enough on the bottom to get caught. Yeah. But take a normal feeding circumstance, like the new moon has always been a big fish moon. I mean, the lady would, every time it did a double capture, you know, like 2 captures within 3 days, was on a new moon 100% of the time. It never did a double capture outside of a new moon period.
What year did we capture? Can you remember?
Can't remember. It's quite a few years ago.
Yeah, I had it 1st of August and you had it 1st of November. I remember those dates. And she was also out twice in the first week of May and twice in the last week of May that year.
Yeah.
with the moon app on my phone, we can actually, if you remember what year it was, we can actually look at what that is now.
Well, we shall do. I say we go into specific detail when we get Sean on. Sean seems to have looked into it way more than I have done. What we can maybe do, a bit of homework for us, is to, in fact, we'll put this out to the listeners as well. Your biggest fish, your PB, messages or post it on the page. We'll get a thread going on our Facebook page and in the official Carpcast Facebook page. We'll get a thread going for date and time of your PB. Only your PB, no other fish. We'll just work on England for now. We'll gather these dates together, and on a future episode, either when we get Sean or we can do it anyway, we'll get my Moon Fishing Cal app out and we'll go through everybody's PB, date and time, and have a look, shall we? How about that for a little bit of live science?
Yeah, we'll see what coincidences crop up.
To be continued. Something else that's on the net this week.
It's on the net. It must be true.
It's something that's happened right now in the last 4 hours.
Is it on the net?
Yes, it's on the net. I'm going to allow you to type and make noise, which normally drives me mad through my earphones. But go on your Facebook now and go to the Environment Agency. While you're doing that, they made a post 5 hours ago with a picture of an otter looking nice and cute, and this post reads, "Otters, which were nearly extinct in the 1970s, have recovered thanks to a ban on harmful pesticides. They are now present in every English county. They've also been helped by a significant improvement in water quality over the past 20 years, bringing fish back to rivers that were once grossly polluted. Otters are at the top of the food chain and therefore an important indicator on the health of rivers." Right, this is the first time you've heard this, Mark. I mean,
yeah, I'm looking at it now.
Right, well, you can see we're 5 hours ago they made that post. There's 372 comments currently. 360 of them are from anglers fuming, as I am. I've made a post on it that so far had 33 likes and 7 replies just to my post. And I only made that 25 minutes ago when I noticed this post. Is this not a PR disaster for the EA? First of all, I agree what they're trying to say. They're trying to say, look what a good job we've done with our rivers. The fact that otters are predating quite happily in these rivers means there's good fish stocks back in them, and that's all because we've cleaned them up over the last 20 years. I kind of get them saying that.
This is a facepalm moment, if ever there was one.
There are 2.5 million anglers in this country, non-sea anglers, something like. They sell just over 1 million rod licences. As we know, probably, I reckon, at least a third of anglers don't buy rod licences. You know, your people only fish once or twice a year, possibly don't even know that you need one. I reckon possibly even half as many, again, as the actual rod licence sales go fishing. You know, you casual people. That's a lot of people. It's worth $3 billion per year, angling to UK economy. And as we spoke with Mark Bryant last week, you know, telling us about how the Cotswold Water Park, 150 lakes there, have been devastated, and the EA don't think there's going to be a reaction to this. This is PR suicide, this post. It's even, I understand what they've tried to do. They've tried to say, look what a good job we've done with our rivers. Everybody likes otters. They're a cute looking creature. Haven't we done a good job? Give us a pat on the back. Where I can't even believe this post is going to stay up. It's that contentious.
It's got to be some, you know.
Somebody's getting a severe bollocking for this. I mean, I suspect you're scrolling through it now.
Yeah, I'm just looking at a few of the comments, and they are exactly as you've described. But there's going to be some, like, you know, social media person who's, you know, that doesn't know the situation with otters and anglers. They just want to make the Environment Agency look good to Joe Public. And
well, the you know, with the new Facebook emotes, there's like an angry emote, there's a like, there's a heart for love, there's on the love, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, you can count them on two hands, there's 10 loves. bearing in mind this post has gone off, 125 shares, 372 comments. There's 260 either likes, loves, or angry face. Out of that 260, 10 of them are love, which kind of tells you the reaction, which way the reaction's going.
Yeah, I've just added to the angry faces myself.
Yes, and me too. There's nearly 200 angry faces currently out of 286 reactions. I mean, oh my goodness. I've made a post that's now got 37 likes and 7 replies. My post says, wow, are we celebrating otters? ? They are wiping out people's livelihoods on a daily basis. Whole areas such as the Cotswold Water Park are being devastated as we speak. 40,000 jobs in angling worth $3 billion to UK economy from government figures, and you're celebrating a predator that is threatening so many parts of the country in the biggest growing sector of angling. That's carp fishing. Disgraceful. And it is disgraceful. If you hear beeps from my computer, it's going off. Somebody else liking that comment. I mean, there's a lot of people getting involved in this. I cannot see this post still staying. I'd be interested. Nobody from the EA is yet to comment. There's probably a group of people sat around the table in an office going, what are we going to do about this? They've pissed the anglers off. And they've pissed them. Now, bearing in mind, even if there is 1 million people buying rod licences or just over at £27 a pop, that doesn't take a genius to work out. £27 million of their funding comes from anglers. Yes, this might be a fact, but do you need to really piss off the people that are subsidising a lot of their jobs? I mean, I've spoke about the EA many times on this show. I believe they do a good job 99% of the time. We've heard a few horror stories about, you know, euthanising fish stocks, yeah, and stuff in certain lakes. But generally, on the whole, they do a fantastic job. They are a government body. Their hands are tied in a lot of occasions. We've tried numerous times to get representatives from the EA on. I actually had a chap message me who works for the EA, who loves the carp cast, who likes the fact that we don't just paint the EA in a bad light. You know, there's a number of good things that they do, the voluntary bailiff service, and that I think they do a good job overall. And if somebody pollutes an area of water, they're going to be out there, you know. And generally, if you get any problems, you can ring them up and they'll come and help, as well as the millions of other things they do with our waterways in this country. They own every bit of water in the country, and you know, they, it's a big job to manage them, but I do believe on the whole they do. I had this chap contact me saying, I'm glad you say things like that, you know, and I'm going to speak to our PR department, he said, because you know, the fact that you give a fair and honest opinion on what we do, I'd like to come on and discuss some of this stuff, discuss some of the stuff that people don't hear about that's going on behind the scenes, and put our point of view across officially. He said, but I'll have to, they don't like people speaking out, so I'll have to check with him. That's nearly 12 months ago, and I've heard nothing since. So I presume he's been told he can't. That is the only assumption I can make. When this guy contacted us voluntarily and said, I love the carp cast and I love how you put a fair point of view across for the EA, you know, I would like to come on an official capacity and talk to you. He clearly wasn't allowed. And the EA, they don't comment about this sort of thing. I spoke with Rob Hughes about this, you know, the EA, like, he's tried to get them up on stage at our fishing show, and they would quite happily tell you things on their stand, because the EA have a stand at the most of the fishing shows. They will quite happily sit there and tell you stuff, but they won't go on the stage and broadcast it publicly in case they can be held to account for it, because everybody's being a government body, they're not allowed to speak out of turn. So Rob's saying, what, you can tell me X, Y and Z while I'm stood here talking to you now, but you're not allowed to say those same things up on the stage? And he's like, yeah, pretty much. I mean, I guess that's the red tape of a company body. But somebody's going to have to come and speak out about this.
Yeah. I've not gone through all the replies. Have anyone from the Environment Agency actually replied to the comments anglers have made?
No, that's what I've been saying. There's now 400. This is going off as we speak. It's 417 comments currently. Nobody's commented from the EA. And this was 5 hours ago this post was made. The EA's head of social media has been pictured leaving the building. it's going to be worth following this post. Check it out, because I'm not sure if it's... I mean, being the fact they are a public body, I'm not sure if they can just remove this post now. I mean, nobody's getting personal. There's lots of people saying, no wonder I don't buy rod licenses. I mean, we should support them financially. It's like saying I'm not paying my taxes because I had to queue in the NHS, you know, I had to wait for a bed or whatever. It's not the right way to show your dissatisfaction with the service, and it's illegal. And make sure you've got your rod licences. We're in April now, and I'm sure there's some people that haven't yet bought them, but please make sure you do, because they are out checking. It's April and May is when they go out doing the checks, and you don't want a criminal record. It's an on the net, it's breaking as we speak, but it's fumed me a little bit. It's somebody's getting their ass kicked for this. I mean, they can make that same point without putting a cute looking picture of an otter. I'm glad lots of people are putting the horrible pictures of carps with their throats ripped out. Many, many people have posted that underneath, and please carry on doing it. You know, I saw a picture yesterday of a 41-pound classic old English carp that had just been ottered. I mean, what's the price on a 41-pound carp if you could buy it in English thoroughbred carp?
What? That's got to be thousands.
Probably
four figures.
Oh, it's definitely four figures. Definitely. 10k plus, you know, if you got a legal one with papers, it's come out of that. It's got to be worth 10 grand plus. I mean, that's a lot of money to somebody. It's nearly a year's wages or 6 months' wages. And a business could potentially have 5 of them, 10 of them killed in a week in the middle of winter. I'm hoping the law's going to change. Something new that we're going to have on the show, and it's something that can keep us up to date on this sort of stuff. We've got a new feature starting this week. We haven't had the jingle made. Sarah, our jingle maker. In fact, I spoke to Sarah today. Well, I've asked her to make the jingles for a couple of new features. I told her how popular. I keep getting messages from people saying that they love Sarah's voice, including Kevin Nash. He's one of them. Rob Hughes the same. He says, absolutely love that girl's voice. Well, she is a presenter on Capital Radio in Liverpool. She used to do the breakfast show. I think she does a drive time show now. And if you wish to follow her or tell her how much you like her voice, whatever you want to do, you can do on Twitter. Her Twitter is @ Sarah Story, as in storybook. Sarah Story Tweet, @ Sarah Story Tweet. You can follow Sarah and tell her how much you've listened to her on the Carpcast if you like. But she does all our jingles and all our drops. But yeah, I've asked her to do a drop for a new feature that's going to be starting this week, and it's called Hughes's News, or Hughes News.
Hughes News.
Hughes News.
I like that.
I'm not going to sing it, but let's get Mr. Rob Hughes on right now. So you're a regular face on the podcast as it is, but we're kind of making it official, giving you a monthly slot. Hughes News, how you doing?
Woohoo! Yes, here. We almost need like a little newscaster's news report before that, don't we? Like the 9 o'clock news and a couple of bongs. Oh, bongs? No, let's not talk bongs.
I will get my creative juices flowing as soon as Sarah delivers the jingle to me. I will put some sort of context with it, I think.
Awesome. Awesome.
Cool. So what's been going on? Loads, I know.
Loads. Well, you know, I was talking to Mozer, actually. I think you've got him on. I was chatting to him earlier today, and he said that he's surprised that there's only one of me, because I seem to be buzzing up all over the place, there and everywhere. Yes, loads is going on at the moment. All amazingly positive for fishing in general. You know, we've spoken about my drive before now, just to try and really push fishing along a little bit more, get it up there, get it out there, get more people doing it and raise the publicity on it. And, you know, it seems to be working at the moment. But the big thing, of course, is that it's St. George's Day today as we're recording this. So happy St. George's Day, everybody. And with St. George's Day comes the announcement of the squad that I'm putting together for the events this year. So, you know, I say events, that's plural. There's more than just the World Championships, but more news of that later on. So, yes, lots of people have said, right, what's happening with the squad? Where's it going to be? How's it going to be? What's going to go on with it? And we thought that being the patriotic so-and-so as we are, St. George's Day is the ideal day to do it.
Yep.
So did a little film this morning, popped it up on Facebook. I've got to say, I've got the figures in front of me as we speak. It went out a little over 2 hours ago. So 2 hours and 10 minutes ago, it actually went up. I'm looking at the reach figures at the moment, which is 20,558. And it's had 6,200 views already in the first 2 hours. So
well, nearly rivaling the EA post figures. Can you comment on that one?
I'm not going to say anything at all about that. I think the word Gerald Ratner springs to mind on that. So no, I think that's something that they need to look at in-house. On a serious note, they need to look at that in-house. Clearly, there's issues that need to be looked into. And you've only got to look at the strength and the breadth of the feeling on that post to realise exactly what the angling population think of what has been said. So that's something that definitely will need to be looked at by the authorities. And, you know, at the moment, that's all I'm prepared to say. But certainly it will be something that I will be very, very interested in. We'll be watching, and if I can have any input into, I will certainly do that. But, you know, that's a matter for official, and it's different to what we're talking about now. Let's talk Team England.
Okay, I just thought I'd try and sucker you in on that one. I mean, if nothing else, I mean...
You always call me the diplomat, Jamie, you should know by now. There's times where I will scream, and there's times sometimes where, you know, we just need to look at things in a very, very serious light, and that one needs to be looked at very, very seriously.
Yeah, just to draw a line on under it, the way the angling community has come out and been very vocal on that post, then it cannot be ignored. There's going to have to be, at least the issue may get addressed now on some levels it wasn't getting addressed before. So it's got to be a good thing.
Yeah, well, again, you know, you say no news is good news, and that whole issue has been around angling for quite some period of time. It's deemed to be a hot potato, and my word, it's just heated up even further. But again, that's not a matter for me. There's other people within our organisation that will deal with that. And, you know, I'm sure that something will have to be said, and be said very, very quickly.
Yeah. So before we go on to the England, just so all of our public, I mean, you are the busiest man in carp fishing. As Mozza said to you, there could be 10 of you. Just spell out exactly your involvement in everything. So we know that you work to promote angling for Sport England?
It's actually, I'm funded by Sport England to work for the Angling Trust, or to work with the Angling Trust, stroke for the Angling Trust. The way that government works is quite strange, and it's been a very interesting, eye-opening experience for me, coming from a private commercial background, being inserted into either a government or a quasi-governmental organisation. But basically, putting it in very simplistic terms, the government are effectively in charge of all government departments, organisations, etc., etc., etc. If they want to do something with regards to the promotion of sport, then they have various bodies that do that for them. Sport England is obviously the department of the government that is involved in the promotion of sport and participation in sport, but they're not a delivery body. So what they do is, for example, if Sport England wants to promote netball, what they would do is look at the British Netball Association. If the Sport England wanted to have a big push on cricket, they would speak to the England Cricket Board. So in exactly the same way, if Sport England are assisting in the promotion of angling, what they do is they look at the angling governing body, and they will assist with regards to funding and policy for someone to assist the angling governing body to do that. And the angling governing body in the UK is the Angling Trust. The Angling Trust are in charge of effectively all manner of things. They're the advisory body to the government when it comes to all things fishing. And also what they do is they set policy with regards to campaigns, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I actually work for the Angling Trust, but I'm inserted into the Angling Trust machine and my role is set by Sport England.
Okay, so that's one string to your very large stringed bow. The final string, which we'll come on to in a sec, is Captain England manager.
Yep.
You also are now employed by BT Sport, I believe.
Yes, I'm.
Subcontracting.
It sort of goes hand in hand in that I have my own business, which is in marketing and promotions. It's called RHAP Media, and for a number of years, 15 odd years, I think, we have made programs which we have given to or sold to television companies for broadcast, primarily fishing, but we've done a few other different bits and bobs as well. But fishing, you know, it's not just my business. It runs through my veins. It's in my head. It's in my heart. The wife will probably tell you that it's in my life permanently. So, you know, I eat, sleep, live, breathe and will die fishing. And as a result, the majority of my business is angling related. So, you know, we do a little bit of commercial stuff for other people, but my company is one of the biggest providers, if not the biggest provider of angling programs to the television world. And some you'll see me in front of camera, others you'll see me behind or won't see me behind camera, and some we just produce and direct. And that goes for the corporate world as well. And recently I've moved from Sky Sports to BT Sports, which sort of goes very, very well, almost hand in hand with the promotional aspects of the job with the Angling Trust and Sport England, in that what we want to do, my role exactly, is to get more people fishing more often. And one of the great ways to do that is obviously to publicise it and how good it is. And the opportunities when BT approached me and said, would you be interested in moving over from Sky Sports to us, are magnificent. So, you know, we discussed the various different ways that we could do that and came up with a deal that we did. So I'm employed in slightly different areas because they've already asked me to do other stuff. I was presenting to Motorsport with them the other day, which I do in my own time outside of work. So that's a Rob Hughes thing. You know, anybody that follows me on Facebook knows I'm a bit of a car nut. And I was out at Lyddenhill for the rally cross, massively into motorsport, used to rally. So, you know, it's a bit of a hobby of mine. So I present television programs in my part-time and hobby work, I suppose.
Okay, and then you do diving, you do underwater features for Carpology, amongst other people along the way. I suppose that comes in your filming and media banner as well.
Yes, I think, it started as a result of me just being an angler and wanting to know what goes on. And, you know, I'm absolutely firmly of the opinion that nature has the answer to everything. Whatever that might be, nature's got the answer to it. And the more we can understand nature, the more we can understand the natural world. And also, if we look on a military strategy, the more you can understand your enemy, the better a chance you've got of beating them. And you'll have to forgive me, my phone's beeping at the moment. It's, with it being release day, everything's been absolutely manic today. The phone's been going. We've got a private Instagram group between the England lads, and a couple of them have already been on and said their phones are going into meltdown, so you probably are beeping all the time when the phone's coming in. But just going back to the diving, started diving, no interest in diving in the sea, looking at funny coloured fish and coral reefs and all of that lark, all very nice, have a bit of a go when I'm on holiday, but I'd much rather scurry around in a cold, wet, muddy pond having a look at carp or other freshwater fish and what the bottom's like and how we can present rigs. So that's how I got into that, and write for magazines all over the world on that basis too.
And obviously, I'm just qualifying you as for the people that don't know, and I'm sure everybody does because you've been a regular guest on the show. But just qualifying you, why you are the perfect person to have your own news column on the show every month, because basically, there's not much gets by you from under the water to over the water to the politics. To pretty much everything. You're about as finger on the pulse as it gets.
It's funny. Well, you know, don't forget, I'm an angler. I'm connected very much with the Fox and also the DNA machine as well. So DNA are my bait sponsors, Fox are my tackle sponsors. I've been with both companies a number of years. So it's not just that I dive, or it's not just that I write, it's not just that I make programs. I am first and foremost ideally an angler, albeit certainly for the last 6 months or so, it's been really, really difficult to get out. I've fished a bit, but not so much. But yeah, first and foremost, I'm an angler. I suppose one of the things when I run the British Carp Angling Championships, and there may be guys that know, there may be guys that don't know, but I set the Carp Champs up in 1999, ran that for a number of years. And we just got to know everybody. And as a result, the office, we always used to have a bit of a laugh because it was the hotbed of news and gossip. And we used to actually have newspapers that would ring us up to find out what the gossip was, because we would normally find it first. And I suppose that's just gone on as I've matured a little bit and got a little bit older, then the level that you're working with goes a little bit higher, I suppose. So as a result now, you know, I know a lot of the guys, we've grown up with them, that are now running all the businesses. I'm very well connected in the political world, because I think it's something that we have to have an input into, and it's massively important. And loads of people think, you know what, it's boring, I'm not interested. That's fine, fair enough. You may not be interested, but it will have an effect on you. And it's one of these things that somebody's got to do it, or somebody should do something about it. Or, and you often hear, that's wrong, somebody needs to do something. A lot of the time, unfortunately or fortunately, whichever way you look at it, I've normally got my nose stuck in there. Primarily just because, you know, I love fishing, particularly carp angling, but I love fishing across the board. I want more people to do it. I want more people to be aware of it. And I just want more people to respect our lovely sport, to be fair.
So that's fantastic. That qualifies you, certainly overqualified for a news feature here. It's St. George's Day, and today you've announced the England squad. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. That's right.
So what have you announced the squad for? What's coming up?
Well, the World Championships is the main thing that everybody looks at. And the World Championships takes place this year in France from the 21st until the 24th of September. So, you know, we've got a few months yet. What's that? 6 months odd away. But that flies very, very quickly. So we need to prepare ourselves as quickly as possible. We need to get a squad together that will work. I don't necessarily believe in picking a gang of lads and saying, right, you're in, that's it, we've got to work with you guys. I believe in working my squad a little bit like a football team, in that sometimes, depending on who you're playing, you will need an attacking squad. Sometimes you will need a defending squad. Sometimes you'll need a little bit of both. And it might be a case of, you know what, last year we had to go knock as many goals in as we can do. This year what we might have to do is sort of close the, or park the bus a little bit, as they say, and try and beat them on a break. Because I know very, very well that the French in particular are massively experienced on their home water. They had their selection process last year, and they run a full selection process. We don't in England, it's manager's pick. But there's a selection process that goes through in France. And what they did was they had three events on the same lake, which is where the World Champs are being held. And the team that got the best average over those three, basically they got points where they finished in the three events. Whoever won goes forward to represent France. So when they go to fish their event on that venue, not only is it their home nation, but they fished four competitions on there under full match rules in World Championship status style events. So, you know, they'll have a massive, massive advantage over everybody else. So for us to go over into their backyard, particularly as one, none of us have ever fished the water. Two, the rules that they fish are very, very different. International rules are completely different to UK and our domestic rules here. And three, we've effectively got a new squad again. You know, last year was a brand new squad. This year, we've got a number of the guys that have stayed in, but we've also got a number of new guys that are coming in, because you know what? I need to see what everybody's like. We need to create a wider squad to allow a greater talent base, because at the moment we don't know what we need. So, you know, very much I'm starting effectively from scratch again, albeit that there is a little bit more experience in the team.
Yeah. So can you tell us the squad?
I can indeed. I'll say who the outgoing members are first, because we're losing two of the angling squad, and that is Paul Booth from Spain. He was he's actually based out in Spain. He's a guide on the Ebro. It doesn't take the brains of Einstein to work out why we got him into the why we got him in last time. And you know, I've said this before, and I'll say it again. Paul was an absolutely massive part of the squad last year, just because of his technical knowledge of the river, the support that he gave us, etc., etc., etc. And you know, a lot of the time people might look at the squad as in, you know, the six anglers that are fishing, but there's a lot more than that. There's effectively four tiers. You've got the lads that are fishing, you've got the subs who are also effectively anglers who were part of the playing squad, you've then got the management squad, and then you've got the backroom squad. So there's effectively four different parts to this machine. So just speaking from the angling side of things, Paul, obviously, he was in for Spain. Magnificent job he did as well. A bit more difficult for him to attend the meeting, come to practice, so on and so forth. So Paul drops out of it. Also dropping out this year is Alexi Bygrave. Now, Alexi was Harry Charrington's partner. He's his regular partner. He's you know, absolutely fantastic as an angler. However, Alexi is, I was going to say he's the brightest carp angler I know. He's probably the cleverest person that I know. He's doing a doctorate in something to do with brain psychology and how the brain works. It isn't just brain surgery. It's actually how the brain works. So neuroscience. And he's got his doctorate thesis at Oxford University to do this year, which coincides with the championships. Now, you can see the level he's at. He basically hasn't got the time to commit this year to be able to do himself proud in both areas. So fair play to him. He's backed away from the fishing because he's got to get his doctorate done. There's nothing to say that he won't come back again. So those are the two guys that are out. Replacing them, I'm recalling two guys that have fished for England in previous years. And one of them is Tom Maker, and the other one is Kev Hewitt. So, you know, Kev Hewitt is known as an awesome catcher of carp. Whether they're big, small, or whether he's catching lots of them or just going out after big ones, he's well known. So he regularly fishes with Mark Bartlett anyway. But I'm not necessarily after just partnerships. I want each individual angler to be able to stand on their own 2 feet. So Kev comes back in, and also Tom Maker comes in. Tom needs no introduction whatsoever again. You know, he's just an out and out machine. He's a big caster. He's a big catcher. And once again, it doesn't matter whether it's big fish or small fish. He's out there and he's catching them. Now, there's another two guys that are coming in as a pairing, effectively, although once again, I want them to be able to stand on their own 2 feet, and that is Wayne Mansford and Ryan Need. Now, if you're on the competition scene, you'll know exactly who these lads are. Wayne has been around right from day one. Amazingly competitive, very, very, very hungry. And Ryan, again, very similar. Ryan won the UK Carp Cup individuals, I think, 3 years ago. He was the last one to win it before Kev Grout won it. And I think Kev Grout's won it 3 years on the bounce now. So Ryan won it maybe 4 years ago. Very good individual angler on his own right. Over the last couple of years, he started fishing with Wayne, and they make an absolutely dynamic pairing. Wayne's been part of the British Carp Championships team, champions for, oh, Lord knows how many times, 3-4 times. Also won an event overseas a while ago. So they've got competition experience, but they are two of the most competitive people that you will ever meet, and they gel together really, really well as a pairing. So they come into the squad as well. And then there's a fifth man who, if you're into the sort of normal carp angling scene, you may have heard of him. If you're into the match angling scene, he's just coming into it, but this boy is absolutely amazing. He's an incredible caster. There's actually a video of him on YouTube where he's casting one of the new Fox Impact spods 200 yards. So, you know, he's a really, really big chucker. He's a bit of a meathead as well. But he's a superb bloke. He's got exactly the right attitude that we need. And that's Carl Pitcher. And Carl Pitcher is, you know, he's going to be a secret weapon without any shadow of doubt. And I'm bringing him in now because I want to develop that lad and push him forwards, because I can see over the next couple of 3 years, he will be a really, really strong player within the squad. So we're taking the anglers up to a reasonable level. The next thing to do is get everybody together and have a bit of a, you know, a bit of a practice, bit of a kick around, and see exactly how everybody performs. Who will be in the starting lineup for the World Championships? As yet, I've got no idea, because what I need to do is get these lads out there, and obviously, the bigger the squad, the more competition there is for places as well. So it's a team effort, but there will also be that competition for place. So everybody has really got to pull the socks up and they've got to push forwards. And I'll be running this like a football team in that we've got a couple of strikers, we've got a couple of defenders, we've got a couple of goalkeepers, we've got some serial big hitters, we've got some very, very good technical anglers, we've got some very, very, very good, what I would class as bag up anglers, you know, people that will catch an awful lot of fish if it turns into that sort of venue. So we've got a lovely mix within that squad. But the one thing is that everybody gets on really, really well. They've got the perfect attitude and also they're massively hungry.
Fantastic. We look forward to seeing how that develops. I love the way you're running it. And let's just talk about the ladies for.
Well, we've got the backroom staff as well. Yeah, I'll just go back to the backroom staff as well before we step on to the ladies, because we talked about the players themselves. But one of the things that I want to talk about is how important that backroom staff is as well. And we had a long conversation a while ago about the bringing in the casting coaches and having Terry Edmonds and Mark Hutchinson in as casting coaches. Now, they're both immense casters, and without any shadow of doubt, they assisted our championships victory last year, because all of the lads were going out with them. And part of the reason why I've got two guys in is that people's casting styles might be ever so slightly different. So I know, having talked to the guys, some people prefer the way that Mark casts because it suits their swing better effectively, and some prefer the way that Terry casts and it suits their swing. So what we'll be doing is we'll be working with the guys on their techniques and what they're going to be doing and how they're going to be doing it. You know, the other guy that was in last year is Martin Hodgkinson from Wolverhampton. He helped out. He's primarily an Ebro expert. He was the Ebro record holder last year as well. So he was on. We've got to speak about what his role and responsibilities are going to be, but again, he's still part of the backroom staff as we speak at the moment. And then as far as management is concerned, there's the two of us. I will stay as effectively the tactical coach, and also the person that will be looking at who we're going to be running and where. Graham maybe is my assistant manager, and Graham's going to be looking at, and you know, you might think this is just fishing, why are we going that far? But believe me, it makes a difference. We look at psychology. We look at training. We look at the physicality. We look at the diets. We look at all of these things. And also what we're almost computerizing our systems to find out what patterns emerge, to show which angler is better at which aspect and which area. We're really, really pushing it forward. We're bringing sports science into fishing.
Fantastic. Fantastic. It sounds like you've got a decent squad, a full team behind you. And I mean, you seem to be doing what it takes to get us another gold medal. And at the end of the day, that's, you know, you do it your way. And that's what we want. The general public want to see that end result, and we want to see it covered on sport, on TV, on BT Sports, all the things that we mentioned previously. Everyone's going to know about it this time, aren't they? When we have a deep one.
Absolutely. You know, we will be trying our absolute hardest. There is no question about that. And, you know, we have a Latin saying within the squad, and this goes to the ladies and the men, and it's numquam redono. And numquam redono is our motto, and that is never give up. And you don't. You never, ever give up. It doesn't matter what time of day or night it is. It doesn't matter how you are. You carry on going. And I instill this into all of the boys and the girls, and I said it to the girls the other day. You carry on going. You don't give up. The only time that I'm prepared for you not to carry on going is when you fall over through exhaustion. And if you do fall over with exhaustion, you've got a partner who will pick you up and carry you, and the rest of the team who will assist you. But you do not give up.
So you mentioned the girls there. There was an England-Wales friendly last week, which we seem to have smashed out of the park. What's the future for the girls team? How much are you involved in that? Are you still the actual manager of that team? And tell us about the ladies side of it.
Absolutely. The ladies were magnificent Absolutely magnificent. And, you know, before anybody dares turn around and say that they're only girls, and I've heard a couple of comments, you know, not massively negative comments, but, oh, the girls are having a bit of a go. No, they're not. The girls aren't having a bit of a go. This isn't a bit of a go. This is our full-on English ladies team. And they were, Jay, if you'd have seen the weather conditions, they were magnificent. The girls in that weather conditions, most of the boys would have packed up and gone home, or most male anglers would have packed up and gone home. It was horrendous. In practice, they had a bit of a practice a couple of weeks ago, and the weather was shocking. It was really, really windy. The bivvies were getting blown away. They carried on. They caught 160 odd fish between them. We get to this match itself, and it's quite a historical match, and we'll come on to that in a minute. But the first day, it rained. It rained all night. The next morning when we woke up, it had changed to sleet, and it was sleeting, and then it actually snowed, and then just before dark, it cleared up, it went really, really cold, high pressure came in, and it dropped down to -2. Unbelievable. Really, really tough conditions. But the English girls, you know, to be fair to the Welsh girls as well, they were great sports. They've come into our backyard. I think they probably didn't realise how tough it was going to be. A, with the weather conditions, and B, how much you've got to work, because there's a massive difference between carp fishing and carp match fishing. And again, I bring this home to all of the guys. Carp fishing is relatively easy, because what you do is you go out and catch a carp. Carp match fishing isn't just about catching carp. It's catching carp quicker and more efficiently and faster and better than the person next door to you. So, you know, catching a carp, you turn around and go, oh, yeah, I've caught 3 or 4 carp from there. Well, brilliant. But if someone's caught 10, then that's not very good. If someone's caught 1, that is good. So you don't judge yourself against the fish that you catch. You're judging yourself against the person that's next door. And the England-Wales competition was it was quite a historic one, A, because it was the first ever all-female international. And it was brilliant that the Welsh team got a squad together to do that, because they're quite a small nation. They're very young. In age of their organisation, i.e. the female department. But having said that, so are we. You know, there was a comment was made as, oh, England have got a better advantage because, you know, their squad's been around a lot longer. No, the squad, the English squad, female squad, is only 13 months old. And actually, that was an England and Wales squad back then, and it was probably in October that they actually set up a split squad. So the first ever all-female event was this time last year. So we're only 12 months old. And for the girls to come on and catch the sort of weights that they did in that period of time shows how good they are. It was absolutely incredible.
Good. And it's always nice to get a little victory over a neighbouring country, a rival country. What future events are planned? Have we got anything in the pipeline?
Well, yeah, the female side of things is actually really, really exciting in that the Welsh squad are off the ground now, obviously, and they are massively enthusiastic. They're looking at building on this event. They're getting more girls in, and what will happen is that we will now go back for a return match into Wales, and we'll fish on their turf against them on their home ground. So the Anglo-Welsh will be an annual occurrence where it'll go back and to in between the two. However, news of it got out, and already we've had a little bit of an interest from South Africa, who said, you know, if it takes off, they'd be interested in putting some a squad together. And also, the French might be able to get one together. Now, I will be meeting a number of heads from other nations at some stage in the next 4 weeks. And what I would like to do, ideally next year, if we could possibly do it, is put together a Six Nations tournament. And I think that would be an absolutely fantastic for female participation, getting a Six Nations tournament put together with a load of different countries coming in. Sorry, the family's just walking back in again. Hopefully there will be a big event with lots of different countries in it. In any event, whatever happens, there will be an England-Wales return match. And a few weeks ago, I went to a Women in Sport conference to look at how some of the other national governing bodies in sport are promoting their female participation. And everybody was really impressed, actually. Firstly, you know, bearing in mind that the RFU, the Women's Rugby Football Union, were there, the Women's English Cricket Board were there, the Women's FA were there, netball, athletics, all of the big sports that you would expect to be sports were all at this conference. And suddenly fishing's there. And they're like, wow, what do you do then? And, you know, it's like fishing. Wow. And it's quite funny because one of the first things that they say is, you don't look like a fisherman. It's like, well, that really annoys me, because what does a fisherman look like? And to non-anglers, it's a bloke with a beard who's slightly overweight, middle-aged, sitting by the side of a canal getting away for his missus on a Sunday morning. And immediately they're like, wow, you're not the archetypal fisherman, are you? I'm like, well... So rather than saying, no, I'm not, I turn around and say, well, what is it? What do you mean? What is the archetypal fisherman? So, you know, very, very different. So, you know, the fact that we've got a female event is great for female participation. It's brilliant that we've got Ladies Team England. But again, the bigger picture, it's great, actually, that we're there, that we're doing well, and that we're out there in that public domain. And we're mixing it with the other sports as well. If you go on Facebook and have a look at the... have a look at the photographs. You look how good those girls look. Look how professional they look. You know, absolutely magnificent.
Yeah. It's so as far as all the England updates go, they need to check out your video that you posted this morning. I'm sure it's probably on 8,000 views by now. We're going to keep you abreast of all Carp Sim England news, all the media stuff that's going on. I mean, what are the upcoming programmes that people have got to look forward to on BT Sport, the immediate stuff in the next 4 weeks?
Oh, the immediate stuff in the next 4 weeks. We're out. The first event that we're covering is the first round of the UK Angling Championships. That's on the 4th of May. That's from Lindholm Lakes. That will be going to air on the 16th of May. I was over at BT earlier, or on Thursday last week, just discussing transmission schedules and meeting a few different people over there about various different bits and bobs and plans. So with the events, you can say within 2 weeks of going out, they will be going out onto air. But Mondays, 7 o'clock, is going to be fishing time on BT Sport. It'll be on probably on BT Sport 1 as opposed to BT Sport 2. So Monday night, 7 o'clock, and hopefully from certainly the 16th of May is the first one. But as and when the eventing season gets on a little bit more, and you can say that from the middle of June, every Monday night, 7 o'clock, BT Sport, there will be something to do with fishing on the telly.
Fantastic. So what sort of fishing is that going to be? Is it going to be everything?
It will be across the board with a little bit of everything, but we're starting off with the competition coverage, obviously, because we're smack in the middle of competition season. We will be out filming the magazine show, but that will go to air probably November time. So competition's first part, magazine show towards the back end. But of course, you know, as is always the case, we'll keep you informed as to what's going on.
Thank you, and we'll see you next month.
Cheers, Jay. See you then.
So thank you to Rob. That's going to be the second to last show of every month. We're going to have Hughes News on the show, and he's going to keep us up to date because, as he said, there's going to be a big England announcement every day this week. He's got all the BT Sports stuff to keep us abreast on. And like Mark just said to me privately, Rob Hughes, possibly the busiest man in carp fishing, don't you think?
Yeah, I think he's secretly had himself cloned 3 or 4 times. To get it all done.
We've been promising for a couple of weeks our DNA feature, DNA tip of the week. Once again, Sarah is making the jingle for us as we speak, but probably not going to have it till next week. But while I've been chatting to Rob this week, I got a DNA tip from him. And this is a particularly interesting one, I think, due to the colour of bait in water, what carp can see, all his underwater findings, and the fluoro pop-up. So let's do the DNA tip of the week.
My DNA tip of the week now is to have a think about the colour of bait that you want to use. And we've got 4 particular baits of the fluoro wafters. You've got pink perils, you've got milky malts, which are white, you've got raspberries, which are a sort of pinky red colour, and then you've got PBs, which are fluoro wafters. And the key is to think about which one you want to use in which water condition. And remember, bright baits stand out best in clear water. If the water's coloured, you need a smell with them. So put a bag out, a stick out, some bait out, and the fish will come into the area on the smell, but then they will find the bait when they're close enough to see it. And these bright baits really do stand out and work well in dark water, but they absolutely come into their own in clear water. The big question now is, which one should you use when? So pink stands out across the board. the standard pink. It'll work at deep water. It'll work in shallow water. It works very well, and it's very different from everything there is underwater. So the bottom of the lake is never pink. So you know that if you put a pink one out, it's going to stand out there. Now, white, the milky malts. What I found with my diving stuff is that white is best either in very shallow water, where it's very bright and it's attracting all the light and it stands out like a sore thumb, or alternatively in slightly deeper clear water where there isn't much light around, and again it's grabbing all the light that it can and it's standing out. In between then, where the light's all right and the water depth is, you know, average, then I think you're better going for a colour rather than just a standard white, because I think it stands out a little bit more. The raspberry fluoro wafters, they are the most visible bait. That pinky, reddy end of the spectrum, particularly because these really are fluoro, they are the most visible bait that I've ever seen underwater. So if you want, again, that visible attraction, raspberries work really, really well. And then the PB fluoro wafters, you might think they're yellow, but again, they've just got that little bit of an extra boost. And a lot of people use yellow baits underwater thinking that they're using a high vis bait. The reality of it is they're probably not. Clear water has got algae in it. So even though you look in and think it's clear, when you look at it laterally underwater, there's green filamentous algae in the water, tiny little segments that make it look green. And if you look at any underwater shot looking across water, it will always be green in fresh water. The light that comes in, particularly at the beginning of the day, but more so at the end of the day, is yellow. Weed is green. Weed stems are yellow. Silt, we know, is not black. The majority of the time, that's more towards the yellow end of the spectrum. So if you're using a standard yellow bait, the chances are that you're matching it to the bottom, and you're not catching because it's a fluoro obvious bait. You're catching because it's more of a disguised bait, because it's more similar to the colour around it. What these PB fluoro wafters have got is a little edge on that, because they've got a fluoro kick, and they stand out just that little bit more. So there's your tip. Pink works more or less anywhere all the time. White, shallow or deep water when there's not much light around and ideally it's clear. Raspberry fluoro wafters, single bait fishing in clear water, or alternatively when there's a reasonable amount of colour in it. And the fluoro wafters on the PBs, the yellows, when you want something just to stand out that little bit more over a yellow bottom.
Yep, super interesting. Now, I've recorded a few of them from Rob, and we're getting them from all the other DNA consultants as well. So hopefully during this DNA advert, dnabaits.com is the website address where you can go and buy all this stuff that Rob and all the other consultants are speaking about. But yeah, instead of a boring old advert, hopefully you're going to get a tip in there that that can help you. And if you wish to buy the fluoro pop-ups, they actually do a fluoro pop-up post free deal. You get 5 tubs of all the pop-ups mentioned, one of each of the mentioned ones. It's £25 post free to your door, and even better than that, you can get a discount using the code CARPCAST5 when you check out. There's a little box to put a discount code in. And thanks to the CARPCAST and thanks to DNA for supporting us, you can get an extra 5% off. And like I say, those fluoro pop-ups, I will be ordering some this week myself after just listening to Rob there. Do loads of other stuff as well. They do the Zig deal, where you get 2.5 kilo of spod mix, bottle of sticky sweet liquid, a pack of Fox Zig aligners, and that's £30 post free to your door as well. Again, you can get a discount off that using the code. They do a great range of boilers. The big one that's in the news all the time at the minute is the Switch. You can use the old favourites, the S7, the Nutter S, the SLK, the Ocean X. You can choose any of their boilers. And again, they do post-free deals on all of those. And the post-free deals include a tub of wafters or pop-ups that matches the boiler, of course, 3 key of matching pellets or stick mix, and 250ml of bait soak as well. And the 5 kilo deal delivered to your door is $59.99. The 10 kilo is $94.99. 20 kilo, $149.99. You can go bigger if you want, 50 key with all the swag, £320. Don't forget, go to dnabaits.com and use the code CARPCAST5 when you check out for your extra 5% discount. And we'll be back next week with a different DNA consultant giving you a DNA tip of the week.
It's on the net. It must be true.
Next, shall I look at something else I've noticed on the net that made my ears prick up a bit?
Yeah, go on.
Ace Razor Point hooks, you remember them?
Yeah.
Yeah, there was you know, quite a lot of money invested into putting the I think I'm fair in saying a bespoke range of car parks on the market, and then along with the rest of the Ace range, you just kind of disappeared. Well, the Hawks seem to have appeared again. Have you seen these?
I haven't seen them, no. I did like the look of the Hawks. I believe Terry Hearn was involved with the design. I mean, he briefly left ESP and went to Ace, didn't he, for a while? And Ace and the rest of their brands. And obviously Ace has folded. Terry went back to ESP, but he obviously had a lot of input in the Hawks, so I'm guessing they're going to be pretty decent.
Yeah, well, it's under the name of Carp Spirit, which I've given a quick Google, and it seems to be a French company. You know, I can't read any of the blurb because I don't speak French. But if you go on eBay and just search, Razor Point, these hooks come up. The boxes are coming. The same hooks?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the same patterns, the same names, and the boxes are the same. They just don't say Ace, they say Carp Spirit. Even in the description, they're claiming to be the same. Oh, we can't do that if they're not.
Well, have you been to China? Oh, I know you haven't been to China. I haven't, but
I know what you're saying, but it's surely no one's that stupid.
You would say that. I watched the Top Gear the other day. Have you seen that Top Gear about the Chinese copies of cars? They have copies of BMWs, copies of they just make them themselves and put the badge on. They look similar, but you can tell they're not the same car. I mean, if they're doing that for motor vehicles, I mean, what's a packet of hooks? Not saying that is what's happening with these hooks. Obviously, I cannot know that, and I believe the write-up that they are claiming to be the original Ace hooks, and they probably are. But when it comes to the Chinese copying things, I mean, they're copying full-blown cars. Top Gear actually did a show that was all about it, and they actually compared like the top three cars. I forget what they were, like a copy Lexus, a copy BMW, and a copy, I think it was the BMW Minis. I think it was one of them. Yeah, they were definitely not as good as the originals.
Well, they're never going to be.
They did crash tests and all sorts on them, and they were nowhere near. How do you feel if you're a BMW? I mean, we had the story of Adam Penning smashing up a stand based on a Corda weed grinder being copied. Imagine if you're Mercedes and they've just ripped off your latest SLK. And it's just a plastic version of it driving around that looks the same.
You're going to be a bit peeved. I'm just getting the... Well, you know what the Wi-Fi is like at my end. I'm just trying to get my phone to get the description of these hooks now. I'm on here.
To be honest, I mean, it makes total sense. I believe that they probably are the hooks. I know Ace spent a hell of a lot of money developing those hooks over a decent period of time. And then obviously for whatever reasons, business reasons, you know, Ace have ceased to exist. Probably costing, the bigger company, Shimano.
Even in the description I'm looking at now, Carp Spirit, Razor Point, BBP hooks with free postage, the best are back.
They've obviously sold them off, haven't they? They've sold off the stock because the hooks had just come in literally as the company sort of vanished. Interesting, though. I will be checking them out, I think.
The hugely popular Ace range of hooks are now back under the Carp Spirit banner. Even, it quotes Terry Hearn and, says exactly what you've just said.
Right.
And then some blurb about Japanese carbon steel, highest quality, blah, blah, blah.
Interesting.
Well, I just found it interesting because, I like their Zig and float, hooks for floater fishing, and I've got one size 8 left and I'm a bit reluctant to use it because it's my last one.
Get yourself an order in. I mean, it's on the net. It must be true.
I do.
Moving on. I think our guest this week, I've got tons and tons of Kevin Nash material that I recorded with him. Some of the earlier stuff as well was fairly interesting while we were having dinner. We had a few conversations going, so I've edited some of that up and I'll split it into topics. We'll get a bit of Kevin Nash out. In fact, should we have him now? Should we get Kevin in?
Yeah, I think we should.
real goal to being obsessed about fishing. We were talking about balance in life, and I think you had natural balances by having a business and inventive, creative mind. So you've that's drawn you away from being a full-time angler.
Well, my aim in life has always been explained by me that first you want to catch fish, then you want to catch bigger fish, then you want to catch the biggest, and then you want to help others catch, and then you want to understand how they work.
Yeah.
And that has been my life. Yeah. Wanting to catch carp when I first got the bug, then wanting to catch more carp, then wanting to catch the biggest, then how many more big carp can you catch?
Yeah.
Yeah. Because you'll never win that one. Yeah. You're like I said, yeah. Wow, yeah, I've just caught the biggest five carp in the world, in England. How great am I? But then the bigger one comes up, yeah, yeah. You can never win that one.
There's no end. There's no end.
There's no end. And so I then found my next challenge was, and passion was the lakes.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'd already, well before that, along the way, going back to the 80s, starting doing carp society fishings, understanding equal or possibly better than catching a carp yourself was giving someone else that experience. So I then went into helping others catch, yeah. And then from that, and with that, the final thing is, well, when I'm fishing for them, I'm not so much interested in holding it, look at me, you know, with this mm-hmm. big fish, in understanding how I caught it, and in enhancing and enlarging my understanding of them and knowledge. Yeah, and that is what makes me buzz now. I just want to understand them more and more. I don't have to even catch them. Which is fun enough, where Fred Wilton was all those years ago.
Yeah.
We used to think, what? You know, when we used to be with David Street and all those lot, you know, Fred Wilton was creating all that great stuff, that bait stuff, and he was handing it over to his disciples. He didn't have to catch them. He was where I finally got to. He just wanted to learn from them. He wanted to get the knowledge. Yeah. And that is the end of the circle. It really is.
Yeah. I think that's maybe getting an older and wiser type thing is, like say when I was younger, I wanted to catch the fish, I wanted to catch more fish, then I wanted to catch bigger fish, and then I wanted to understand why I catch them. You know,
you're like, still young. How old are you?
44 soon.
For
your
age, I just wanted to hammer
everywhere. Yeah, I've always.
So to say to an angler, actually, I'm not bothered about catching them, but I just want to learn how they think and understand more about them. Yeah. To say that to an angler, what? You don't want to go out and.
I've always been a bit like that. Like, that was my issue with Zigrigs when they came out, was you're not learning anything. You don't learn a single thing about
Jamie,
that fish.
You've got Zigrigs so wrong.
I know that now.
No, I don't think you do. I don't think you've even touched on the...
Good. I'm glad we're moving on to something technical. I had this chat with Ronnie DeGroote, who told me about a session up on the church where they were catching on zigs. I think it was his mate, actually, it was someone else who was catching next to a weed bed. He was fishing zigs, they were blanking, they started catching on zigs, but only right next to this weed bed. And he was, because it was the bait trapped in the weed at different levels, because he was catching at this depth, but he wasn't catching anywhere else. Any other, it was spotty. It was a zig rig, but it was a spotty zig rig. Put a zig anywhere else, it didn't get a bite. But I think the guy had five or six there. I think it's somebody you know. It wasn't actually Ronnie, but Ronnie was here.
Yeah, I know.
So that opened my mind to zigs. Because I always thought, right, you put a zig rig out, you've not created a situation, you've not fine-tuned that spot, you've not got the fish feeding. It's
so
just
wrong, Jamie.
Curiosity. It's grabbed it in the middle of
Jamie, you're so
no wrong. Man's land. Okay, go on.
Jamie, you and me share a same thing. We're about bait and creating a situation. You know, when you're talking about, you know, single baits, you know, I'm with you, yeah. Yeah, if you want to catch fish and they're all in a sanctuary, whack a bait over that sanctuary and cast to it, you know, and you have an edge. You know, that's some of the stuff Frank Worrell is on about.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I guess if you're a fishing carp angler, you're not going to sit on your hands if you can find an edge to get you those fish. But to me, and I think like you, the gratification is creating a feeding situation, putting your trap in there, and then the indicator rises.
Yeah.
Agree?
Working something out, knowing that at this time of day, they're going that snag bus there, so I'm going to fish there at 3 o'clock. Like, you've done something.
Yeah. Now let's transfer that to Zig. And why it's so frustrating to me that 99% of anglers won't grass Zig fishing, because it's a method to only use when they're struggling. Giving up on anything else, I'll chuck a Zig out.
Mm.
So invariably, it's one Zig in the middle of nowhere, and it's a blank.
You just summed up my Zig fishing.
Yeah. And so they're never going to get onto it.
Mm.
Whereas the harsh reality is that carp, this is just a figure. Yeah. There's no... But let's say 10% of the time they're on the bottom where they might have found their body bait, which they're fishing 100% of the time, except for the 1% of the time when they're blank, they might chuck a Zig up, whereas the fish are 90% of the time in that area
in
where only 1% of the time they chuck a bait there.
Yeah.
Right? But just carrying on that before I get to where I'm going, the only way to get constants in Zig fishing is to make that leap of faith and do it properly. Not one rod, put all on it. Yeah, it's the most successful periods of my fishing have come from going on to an easier water, or more specifically, my benchmark water is always Starlane.
Yeah.
Yeah. Go over there, fine tune, new methods, experiment until I get it right, then move on to, you know, my next big challenge. Yeah. I've always done that, you know, and my advice would be for anyone, you need to get on Zigs because they are so effective, but you need to get competence. So go on somewhere where, you know, you can get takes and learn to fish them, or you're prepared because you're not sitting there wanting to catch a target fish, you're just going for a fun session. Go on that type of lake and invest all your rods and energy in it to get it right. But now we move on.
I'm somewhere between the two on Zigs. So
now we move on, Jamie.
Yeah.
To a new dimension that I want to try and get into it. You and me are both about creating the feeding situation.
Yeah.
Right? There is two ways with Zigs you can create a feeding situation. The first one is the most lethal method I've come across in recent years of emptying a lake, and that is fishing Zigs an inch below the surface, or more likely on the surface, and feeding riser pellet over it.
Yeah.
The method is lethal. You can empty a lake in minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've done that on small fish waters where you're fishing literally an inch below, almost like a surface bait.
With the riser pellet, you can empty, you know, I think we did a DVD a couple of years ago where I went to that club lake where that big common, and I think we showed me catching 6 carp in an hour or whatever. Mm. In actual fact, you know, I dropped as many, you know. And those fish have never seen that approach. You know, there's certain anglers, what's the northerner?
Henderson.
Not Henderson, who's the other? Lee Birch.
Oh, yeah.
Lee Birch has got it to a fine art now. And he's milked a couple of waters, hasn't he?
Yeah.
Slaughtered them
on the surface, yeah.
But, yeah. Where I'm getting at it is how I fish nowadays now. I've taught Alan, is, you know, we've only got 24 hours once a week, and we can go on a lake and through various methods like that catch in a day what anglers are catching all year.
Mm.
That's one way, and that is your feeding situation.
Yeah.
The other way that is not being touched on or explored, and it's something I have been into, and it's why I called that Big Common twice in less than 24 hours, and I officially laid twice in 24 hours, is by watching the lake and the natural hatches. When I was on Cavanagh with Rachel, you know, my best mate, who is a fly fisherman lady, and she was invited to fish for the English fly team, that's how good she is. We just sit there with her. She said, there's a hatch there. What? In all my carp angling life, I've never watched a lake and for hatching.
Yeah.
Right? But it's so bleeding obvious when you latch onto it. There'll be certain rich areas of the lake where there's hatches going off. Throughout the year, in certain areas of the lake, there is larders of natural food that is hatching.
Yeah.
In the spring, it'll be the shallows where the sun hits it. In winter, and I've seen hatches right into December, in deep water, you get a sun on a freezing cold, bright day, you get... Yeah, the insects fold into thinking, you know, it's great weather, and they hatch, and as they hatch and hit the surface layers, they die. But there's hatches going on 12 months a year. That is where the essence of zig fishing needs to go, where I'm onto and where those who get onto will really make hay. So you are watching that lake for the hatches, and you're presenting that zig right on top of a massive baited natural feeding area, which is exactly what happened on the top when Ronnie and his mate were on there. They put that zig on a spot where there was a hatch going off for 2 days, and that's why that one spot only produced all those fish, because the fish were there, half's in the hatch.
So you think it's like the fly anglers? Do you think we will get a knowledge of what hatches when and...
I'm saying this is a massive, exciting avenue
nobody's of carp really gone
fishing
down
to carp. Open up to. Yeah, if and those who are on it, in time, will massively reap rewards. Because carp have been hammered on barleys for 30, 40 years.
Yeah.
There's this whole exciting world of zig fishing where you chase them in... You know, zigs work because they weren't used to... being caught midwater, where they've been feeding all those areas. Yeah, it's a safe area. You know, the most successful methods are something they're not scared of.
Yeah.
Just like the chod. You know, the chod rig was never about the rig. It was about it was being chucked on areas where carp felt safe because you couldn't present the rig there before properly.
Yeah.
Now, this whole zig thing is optimising where they've been feeding and getting away with it midwater.
No danger.
90% of the time. Yeah, and we've been going about it in a really bad way by offering a lure, which is where me and you agree.
Yeah.
I've just said there's two ways where we can transfer that lure approach to a baiting approach. One is with riser pellet, and the other is putting your lure where they are,
where
the natural bait is.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's so exciting, and I love it.
So
I love it.
Like, take a pressured lake, right? Think of the most pressured lake you can picture, where angler pressure is dictates what fish do.
That's where you're about to monopolise it.
Yeah. So you get a lake where, like we know, if we get a lake that's never been fished, it's quite easy to fish, right? Even if it's low stock, I've fished 100 acres with a handful of fish, but they do what you expect them to do. They turn up on a nice warm southerly. And you generally catch them, like, because they're not expecting to be caught, they're acting naturally. So you think of the opposite end of the spectrum
this
to that.
Where you'll reap harvest.
Yeah. So you go to the opposite end of the spectrum. So you go to the one where the fish back off a new wind because they know there's going to be 50 leads thrown at them. They know it's danger to move on a new wind. You know, you must picture lakes where they really do the opposite of what we're conditioned to know that fish naturally do, because they're heavily pressured. Circuit waters, you know, I fish a lot of lakes where the fish don't move on winds, they move on the back of the wind. And I'm sure it's because they know they get 50 leads thrown at them when they move on the wind. So,
I disagree.
Okay. But it's just something I've found. There's certain lakes that used to fish on winds, now fish on back winds.
I'll tell you why I disagree. Yeah, after you've finished.
Okay, so we move it on to... On those sort of lakes, I believe we catch when they want to get caught, right? When the urge to feed, spring, new moons, autumn, when the urge to feed overrides the fear of danger. I think that's when we catch them, because even the nods catch people that haven't fine-tuned it, haven't done everything. You get a night where everything goes right and everyone on the lake catches. You might catch five and the guy down the way catches two, but the fact is even the duffer catches two, because the fish have dropped their guard because the conditions are so good. It's that perfect day.
Store that.
Okay. Why are the conditions so good? But we know when that happens.
Are the conditions so good? I said.
Okay.
Why? I said, store that.
Okay. So anyway, my thoughts is I believe that every a few times a year, they drop their guard so heavily that everyone catches.
Yeah.
Right. The efficient anglers catch more, but everyone catches. Right. Because they almost want to get caught. It's like their urge to feed overrides danger. So, do you see a point where zigs and even chod fishing in weed, I'm putting in the same category, you know, areas that fish now, the reason why those tactics work so well is because the fish are off their guard, right? So do you think when everyone uses zigs 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, that the fish will then get wary of feeding mid-water? Do you think we'll get to a point where they're used to getting hammered? Take a lake like the Oxford Lakes, where there was a zig craze on there 5 or 6 years ago, your St. John's, all them lakes. They're 6 foot deep, and it must have been like a minefield for him, because you've got 50 anglers with three rods out each on 4 foot zigs, and literally, they must, if you picture those...
I can't answer you in this manner.
Yeah.
Let's go back to when the hare first got out to the masses and how pissed I was.
Yeah.
This major edge had gone, or, you know, you're talking about ego. This is for sure. I put my hands up and ego. Suddenly, Mr. Nod next door was catching as many as me.
Yeah.
But how long did it last?
Yeah, the thing is with the hair rig, it's mechanical because of the way they suck it in.
The point I'm trying to make to you is you have this massive area of water, completely unfished, where fish lived and fed for 90% of the day. So it was like the original hair rig. Give it to Noddy and he would have caught.
Hmm.
The carp soon wised up to that, yeah, that they was being fished for, right? What has not been exploited is properly fishing for them in those
in
areas.
In that manner. Yeah.
They are not muggy enough to go and pick up a pop-up now mid-water, 10 foot up, or a lump of foam. But they are cropping food sources.
From those areas.
So you've got a column of water where there's a hatch going off. And so they are feeding in that column of natural food that is coming up as it's hatching. This is a whole area, exciting area, where, as I say, have an edge, a method they haven't been caught on, exploit it, and you'll make hay. Going back to you and this back of the wind business and all that.
The pressured lake.
I'm so clear on that. And it goes back to, again, Warnwell. Rate Warnwell. She says in the book I'm writing, the next spring, Aplin, the bailiff, netted it. We won't go into that, what his motives were. But I went down there because I wanted to see that netting to make sure the carp go back. And out of interest, also wanted to be able to get in the lake and see where the carp were in the winter.
Hmm.
I was stunned. He took out 2 ton of, there's a lot of goldfish crosses and stunted common things. Took out 2 ton in a lake of, God knows, an acre and a half, or yeah, the biomass of a lake that can naturally really contain is half a ton.
Mm.
So he took out 2 ton of rubbish fish, you know, and God knows how unsuccessful that netting wasn't. You know, and all the carp went back, and the carp biomass was off the scale because they had this string going. Anyway, where this is going is, next June, we're all there. I think the fourth or fifth day into the opening, only one carp had been caught. You know, we're pulling our hair out. You know, the two northern lads I was with, great anglers, got to know. You know, like, every day we're going up the bar to have to have something to eat, get a couple of drinks, and I've always been a great believer when you're hitting your head against the wall, get off the lake. You know, so we have a chat. You know, we go up to that bar completely dispirited, completely demoralised. We make a new plan and go back. 24 hours we're back there. Anyway, I think about day 4 or 5, we're sitting there, and one or two men said, you know, when are these carp going to start having it? I looked out, I said, they are having it. I said, look out, there's fizzing everywhere, but nowhere near where an angler put bait. And that is where the simple enormity of it hit me. They know they're being fished for.
Yeah.
Yeah, and when you grasp that, yeah, you're not tricking them. They know they're being fished for. So where I'm going with this, if you give them an alternative where there's no danger, they will always take it if the food source is big enough.
Yeah.
The reason they're on the back of the wind now, and whatever you say, because they're not prepared to take the risk on the front of the wind, right? The reason you're catching them on the new moon is because the food source ain't there. I'm clear on that. Yeah, when they suddenly latch onto angler's base, it's because the food sources aren't there. They're hungry. Yeah, and it's as simple. If there's an alternative food source to one we're hooking it, they won't take that risk.
Of course, yeah.
You know, and so these periods you're stating, you know, and these situation you're seeing where suddenly they now it's working back of the wind or new moon or whatever, it's because they've got to take the risk. So finding the scenario where they're comfortable and they don't feel they're under risk is the way to go forward, and that's what I've applied all through my carp fishing, which is why I'm so excited about exit fishing. As I say, we've now got to have the mindset of a trout angler and start understanding the insects and the hatches and looking for the signs of the hatches rather than, you know, and that comment I told you about, you know, so I fished that lake twice and for 24 hours videoing both times on Zig Bug. It's because I was thinking like a trout angler. You know, I went where I saw there was a hatch going off both times, and that's where the big comment was.
So, I mean, the way I notice a hatch going off, I've only ever seen it in, like, spring times and stuff. I wasn't aware till you just said about the, you know, the stuff that goes on other times of the year. But generally in the spring, when you used to fish the big lakes, the fen drain and stuff, you'd see the seagulls hammering the surface. And that's, for me, that's my only indication of a hatch going off. And I've fished on lakes where there's clearly a hatch. The seagulls are hammering the surface and the fish are nutting like mad. You see them one after the other, but you can't get a bite, right? Now, this is pre-Zig Rig days. This is when we were fishing on the bottom for them. And it was rare that you would pick a bite up, but you'd be in the peg because obviously you can see the seagulls going crazy. You know they're on a hatch and you can see the carp nutting every 5 seconds. I'm talking places like Fendrayton, you know, tough places. So how do we know when other stuff's going on? Like, not that blatant.
Well, the indications I use are they're buzzing around you. Yeah, but as Rachel told me, watch the lake surface. Yeah, you'll see all this dimpling in specific areas. Yeah, where, you know, there's a bed of whatever insect underneath, and so they're coming to the surface. Yeah, and so as they hit the surface, you see that. Yeah, we're used to watching carp and fishing or whatever, but if you open your mind and really start studying, you'll see insects on the surface. Yeah, yeah. And interesting talking about seagulls. I was on a reservoir once, and if I don't do what I knew now. Yeah.
Yeah.
It was a December day, bright sunshine, and I watched a couple of coots out of the middle, and I watched the others all go to the middle. And I thought, what are they doing? And I cast a body out. It's in 24-foot water. And I got a take. I lost a bugger, actually. It was a bastard, because it's one of the few takes on this water. And then, yeah. So I piled all three rods out, and all the coots and all the seagulls converged, right? It's clearly something was going on. I never got another take, right?
Mm.
The next morning, I got a phone call. This guy, right up the other end of the lake, had done a night in the gay corner. And he said, Kevin, I had lioness and carp all over me last night. Yeah, unbelievable. He said, you know, just, but I never got a bite. So I grabbed my rods and shot straight back over the lake and went into that corner. As soon as I moved in there, the whole corner was this thick in shells.
Mm.
So even December, you know, there was a hatch. And this is what I was saying earlier. I think hatches happen all year long. This hatch was fooled by the bright sun in deep water. As it come up, it hit the cold water and they died. Then the wind blew them into that gate corner. Mm. And the carp followed all those, you know, insects into that corner and were feeding mid-water on the top. He had his baits on the bottom, getting all his lines, and never got a carp.
I've seen that happen with people fishing floaters. I watched Terry Hearn on Yaley, had all the fish in front of him in Trumptons on a hot day. And the wind got up, he was feeding floaters, he was fishing a suspended, as they were called then, but what we know as a zig now, just under the surface, and he was floater fishing. He never got a bite, but he did have the fish going. They were, Bedman, Yaley, there weren't many fish, and they were big ones. He had them going. I was stood in his peg, excited, watching these big mouths take this. And I watched them all drift down. They just followed it. Like, the wind got up, it blew into the gate corner again, and a guy caught a fish that night out there. 100%. It was like a dog on a lead. The bait made those fish go away from in front of Terry down there, and then they obviously stayed there for the night, and a guy had a bite overnight. And bites were rare occurrences then. You know, it wasn't like a daily thing. It was not even a weekly thing. Maybe, I don't know, maybe one bite a week.
Yeah.
Three on a good week, but then nothing for 3 weeks. You know, it was a bite a week was a significant occurrence. And 100% those fish... So, if you look at that from a, you know, let's train the fish, let's lead the dog on the lead instead of just letting them do what they want. Technically, you could do that. You could feed the surface on any given day.
James, what
feeding area.
Rise a pellet. Yeah. That's the other way. Yeah, yeah. They, you know, that ticks all... Yeah.
I've seen fish get addicted to riser pellets. Right, so yeah. This is not a sales pitch, is it? There's something about them. It's Jamie, unlike dog biscuits.
Jamie, let's put a caveat in here. Yeah. I never, ever try and sell. Yeah. I just tell what I believe. Mm-hmm. To help other anglers. And the riser pellet is an incredible product. It's a pellet, and its secret is a percentage sink, right? And
they're tiny as well. That's the thing about it.
Yeah, and yeah, the first time me and Basie used it, it was a sheer fluke and accident. Yeah, we thought we had a floating pellet. He'd been supplied a Duff pellet. Yeah, and I threw it in the mic. I said, "You fucking idiot! This is sinking pellet, right?" But yeah, we was in shit. We'd driven to Cambridgeshire, but we noticed an element of it floated. So we had no choice but to use it.
Yeah.
The first time I used that pellet, I was gobsmacked. Yeah, I was. Yeah, we was beach caster fishing.
Yeah.
On the water, we said, been hammered on floater, chum mixer, and Nigel Bobway had absolutely hammered it. We hadn't been able to get in on the action. We had to work, hadn't been there for 6 weeks, missed it all, and we had to do this video. And Nigel said to us, forget it, they don't take flow anymore. So that's what goes, okay, let's try a little pellet, might work, instead of a mixer. Yeah, and then the bloody stuff sunk. Yeah. Yeah, we've got a video crew, yeah. A load of pellet sinks, but a little bit floats. We've got to try. I could not believe it. I was catapulting it out. and from nowhere, every carp come from the lake. But what absolutely gobsmacked me, they weren't coming up, you know, vertically and sucking it. They had their whole shoulders and backs out the water, going along the surface, troughing it. Yeah, and when you really fish riser, Pete, you're going to a water, some waters for sure it don't work, no bait works, but you know when you've cracked it, if when you start feeding it in and they are out of the water,
you know, yeah,
shoulders out, troughing, that is when you know you're going to slaughter it. And you know, and what happens with riser pellet is you need to get a wind behind you and just catapult it out, little and often, and you start a stream going out. And its massive edge is that it's at a percentage is sinking. So you're drifting out, you're covering a large amount of area, so you're covering a large amount of area where carp are swimming around, laying the bottom, whatever, and this starts sinking around them. And they just go bang and go straight up to the surface to investigate. It's almost like a hatch in reverse, or maybe some hatches do rise and then certain element sink.
Yeah.
Sink. The only thing I can say is, it's so natural to them. And when you see it for the first time, it's an oh my God moment. You know, the reaction is just crazy. So it must maybe replicate a hatch. It goes up, a lot comes down.
I think it's more simple than that. I think the simplicity is you'll know from when you've been surface fishing and floater fishing, you can get them going and then maybe you lose one or maybe you hook one, but they all of a sudden learn that they're being fished for on the surface. So there's all of a sudden there's every surface bait is danger because they all of a sudden they've just realised that you're fishing from on the surface. So you're now surface fishing X percentage of the time, whatever that percentage is, but let's say 50% float and 50% sink, right? So 50% of the baits they eat, even if you hook one, they go, maybe danger. 50% they're eating free with zero danger. So it's kind of what I was getting onto before about maybe it's just as more simple of you're just trying to do something that they don't understand is bad for him.
I'm hearing you, but it just strikes me. I don't think the lifespan of the method is year in, year out. You know, I don't even think it's a year.
What I'm saying is they're taking it all in the top third of the water. Some they're eating on the surface, yeah, some is just below, some is third.
Yeah, I'm not disagreeing. What I'm trying to say, I'm listening to you, I'm trying to factor into my experiences. I'm talking about you've not even fish form yet. The first time you apply it, if it's a kind of water, the reaction is just unbelievable.
Yeah.
If you watch In Pursuit, the first time I did it on the cops, yeah, where I had the regular brace,
yeah,
50s on the floater, yeah, you look out there, every damn fish in that copse is on the surface troughing.
Yeah.
Yeah. An unbelievable spectacle that has never been seen before or repeated since. And just listening to you, when you do hammer water on the method, it's not a year in, year out. You probably would do it within weeks. A bit like I'm thinking sweet corn.
Yeah. Yeah.
One of the most, if not the most effective bait known to man.
And it blows very quickly.
So yeah, I'm kind of trying to factor same the
yeah,
rise.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
But I'm saying like that method of yellow on the bed, like there's a reason why it blows quick because it's extremely blatant. They get attracted to it because it's sweet corn. They like it. All of a sudden, a load of them get caught and they go, shit, that fucking attractive bright yellow stuff is dangerous, right? With risers, only a percentage of it is dangerous. Well, in fact, not less than that because some sink in. So if you equate, I don't know, let's say you put, I'm making this up as I go along. Let's say you had a single hook bait on the bottom, right, that was bright yellow. So the danger rate on that is 100% because every time they try that bright yellow thing on the bottom, they get caught. Right?
Jamie, we're talking about different things, mate. We're talking different things, mate.
See what?
I'm talking initial reaction before you've called them, but I'm also saying to you, I'm not sure it's got a long use date. So you're trying to say is...
I'm saying it might do have a longer use date.
I'm saying in my experience of fishing, it doesn't. It's such a lethal bang, bang, bang. And they see
you're saying is because maybe it replicates something natural so quickly, they're straight onto it. I completely agree. Every time I put it in anywhere, they've gone crazy. That so much so, I've had problems when there's other fish in the lake other than carp. If you try and put it in anywhere, and I've done it a few times, where I put it in where there's all of a sudden the ropes, the rod, everything is going mental on the top. It turns fish on to the highest degree I've ever visibly seen fish. I'm sure it happens underwater.
And that, by the way, is another area which people ain't getting. They're not working through that.
Yeah.
I hope me and Anna are going to prove that this year on one very famous water where it's been tried.
Mm.
It don't work because of the roach.
Because of everything else. Everything else is so hungry, it gets onto it first. I've had that happen.
But anyway, the point was, there's two methods where the zig has so much potential. You can either use it as a baiting situation, riser pellet, or the whole massive area that's excited me for years. You know, I'm not about bodies anymore. I'm not about Nash bait. I have a company that produces Nash bait. Yeah, I want people to use it. I'm not using Nash bait much now
because it's
lost its edge. You know, boilies, boilies, pellet, all that artificial stuff has lost its edge. Yeah, because carp have had it thrown at them for so long. Yeah, I'm looking for new edges, and which is why I went from maggots to fishing snails. Yeah, worms is another one. There's massive potential for guys to get onto worms. I'm saying to anglers, if you want to fish like the rest and catch just an equal share, then fish boilies from Nash mate bait or main on a worm. But if you really want to be a top angler and slaughter waters, you need to get out of the box and start now looking at the natural element, or whether it be by naturals, because we haven't nailed them on them. When I say natural, I'm not saying maggots, or replicating what they're doing and getting away with, because they only take a risk on a boilie when there's no food there, which is why, as I'm saying, zigs is so exciting. The new dimension is thinking and understanding like a trout angler and putting that zig on top of a hatch. The hatch is your baiting, the zig will be your boilie.
So it's single hook baiting amongst
the
natural
area,
food larder.
The baited area, which is a natural hatch.
Yeah.
How much is it costing me tonight? This is half my book I'm blowing here. Is that interesting though, Ziv? I'm so excited about zigs, John. Can you see where I'm going?
Zigs are, I've been sceptical, although I've used them, and one thing, I mean, you described me before when you said most people's experience of zigs, so when things are not going well, they bang wad right out on a zig. That's me. Right, 100%, except I've caught more fish per rod hour on zig doing that, half-heartedly whacking the zig out because nothing else is happening, one rod out of four, and still had two bites, and I've only used it for 10 hours in the session when I've had three other rods out for a total of 36 hours or 72 hours. So my zig per rod hour bites...
You recall it?
Yeah. It's ridiculous.
What you're cutting. Yeah. I used to love reading Tim Paisley's stuff because I was stunned how he just didn't seem to get it. And things that fascinate me with Tim Rowe, for example, he'd go on a session and it was about building up his swim. He wouldn't expect to get a bite for 3 days.
Hmm.
And I used to read that with bewilderment.
I used to be that guy.
I was only fishing 30 days a year. Tim two in three sessions has done my year's fishing. You know, I've always been about a time motion study. I've got to get that result quick because I work for a fucking living. You know, I get 24 hours or 22 hours once a week if I'm lucky.
Yeah.
But I think what's happened in the last 5 years, I'm more focused on that, and I've got a bite angler as a as an apprentice to mentor, and now he's far better than me because he's a raving idiot, a raving maniac, and you know, he's awesome, Alan. And so, you know, we only want to go fishing 2 hours a day now. Yeah, we've got too many other things to go. Anyway, we're bored if we fish more than 2 hours. Yeah, it's almost like that. You know, so it's about a massive, what is the quickest way to get the result?
Yeah.
And when you get that mindset, you know, I used to say for years, the dangerous angler is the day angler.
Yeah.
I learned that from Savvy. To get on Savvy, you have to do a year as a day angler.
On days, yeah.
The bastard, sleep in the car, you know. And I so wanted to get in that Savvy syndicate, but unfortunately, I had the business. So I watched all my great mates, Phil, Harper, Zen, Boko, join it, and I had to gut it, you know. Not joining, which is how I got the silver. Got the result there. But the point I would make is the most effective anglers were on Savvy were the ones until they got on the syndicate. Because every day was a new session.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the day angler, like I say, he is the most dangerous because every day is a new session. The longer you're on a session, the more ineffective you get. Naturally, laziness and blah blah blah. You know, me and Adam have now fine tuned that to we're looking to methods now to go to a lake, get in there, hit it, and get out with the result. As I say, methods like the riser pair, fish over zigs, is one of those methods.
So, going back to the old school at Savvy Syndicate, did those day anglers catch plenty of fish? Because I looked at that day syndicate when I was young, when I was first driving, and I wanted a Savvy ticket. I read Hutch's book and I wanted a ticket, and I looked at that day thing and thought, wow, that's like just too much for me, traveling as well, sleeping in the car. Were they catching fish at the time?
Those day anglers probably caught 2-3 times more fish on the season they did as a day angler as they did as a syndicate member. It's as simple as that. As soon as they got in that syndicate, they got in that rut of sitting in swims. Yeah. They were so lethal, those day anglers. As soon as they joined the syndicate, their catch rate just crashed.
Yeah. And the other doubt was would I ever... I lived up north, so I didn't know anybody. I wasn't connected. I didn't know anyone who fished there. It would have been a case of buying a day ticket, turning up, fishing the days. And I interpreted it as if you face fitted, you might get a season ticket.
In my case, you know, I was never going to get a ticket. That was my clip. What was his name who ran it?
Yeah, I know. Pete Broxup, was it?
Yeah. I was in the Horse and Barge one night where I heard him say, Nashie's never going to get a ticket as long as I run this lake. Yeah, so that's why I never bothered. But yeah. Yeah. The likes of Phil Harp and that, you know, they'd skip in the, you know, they're coming from Essex. Mm. So you drive all that way up, you sleep in the car, you'd be up at first light, you'd fish till dawn, dusk, then sleep in your car, or go to the pub and then sleep in your car, and then get up the next morning and do that. You know, hard graft. Yeah. Week in, week out. But the point I'm making is you're focused and you're putting the energy in. If you're just sitting in a bivvy, life's too easy, isn't it?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. And more so than that, that's something we spoke about earlier was the guy that Kev Hewitt and this Nigel Ramsbottom has been hammering the day ticket lakes. They're both working guys, both on limited time a week, both fishing match tactics, regular casting, regular baiting. These are guys that are excelling. And I've said for a long time, a match angler coming into carp fishing will devastate it because a carp guy gets his one bait. He thinks, right, I'm going to use scope it squid for the year, right? It's a one color boilie. He fishes the same methods year in, year out. I remember back
to... Not a bowly, but rig.
I remember back to... Yeah, rig and methodology. He puts a marker float out, he finds a spot, he puts 10 spots around it, he puts a bait on it, he reels the marker float in, he sits there till it rips, he recasts it at 7 a.m. every morning for the next day. Like, the whole regime of carp fishing is regimented. On the, if you're fishing for 48 hours, you probably do the same thing on the first 24 as you do on the second 24.
But, and this, you know, is where I am against the modern carp scene and the people that have made it and championed it. I won't mention companies, but they brainwashed anglers. Is you go for a weekend, you get your spod out and spod the hell out of a swim and sit there and wait for it to happen. And it is sad that so many have followed that and so many have not experienced the results. Yeah, and what is really sad out of all this, there's now this mindset that unless I can camp out for 2-3 days, I haven't got a chance. Where actually, you'd have a damn sight more chance if you let all those campers turn up, pick their swims, and then you just nip in amongst them for a few hours, fishing effectively, with a float fish worm in the margin or riser pellet and whatever, you'll hammer them.
Yeah.
You absolutely hammer them.
I've seen it so many times. I mean, we keep all going back to the same point, and the point is about doing something different. Carp, they go to the in-between pegs. They'll go to the peg that no one's fished for months, especially the bigger ones. That's where they'll decide to chill out because it's easy, because it's safe. They'll eat off the spots that they never get fished, where the spot spill falls, where the guy that flicks the boilie in the edge when he finishes.
It's funny, talking to Mike today too. Mike, who's, just about going to Manor, and he opens April the 1st, and, he said, I'll go up that first weekend if I get a swim, blah, blah. And I told him a story where this youngster working with me called Paul Tolley, I actually told him to leave in the end because he didn't have a future in mesh. He's the kind of guy who I knew had his own mind and needed to have his own business. He's now a very successful ground worker, loads of bulldozers and whatever. It still does all my work. Love him to bits, because I've seen him go on and make his own way. But anyway, he was mining that at Gary's little apprentice somewhere. He got him in the manor. And he rang me Whitsun weekend. He's turned up. So I'm on the ground. He said, but I ain't going to fish. I said, why's that? He said, because there'd be swims taken. I said, oh. I said, well, everyone's taken. He said, well, there's one left. I said, how long have they been on there? He said, oh, like, they've all been on here. I've seen yesterday. I said, go in that swim then. Mm. 2 hours later, he rang me back. He got the amphibian. The amphibian wanted to get away from all the lines of anglers, so he just went in that one area of the lake that was safe. Yeah, they caught it.
That's exactly it. They go for. I mean, everything comes to full circle back to the same point. Doing something to trick them, doing something different.
Different.
Catching them in either a depth that they don't normally get caught in, or on a rig that they don't normally get caught on. Let's look at rigs. Yes, the blowback rig is your favourite rig and my favourite rig. It's my go-to rig. If I can fish that on a clean spot, I'll do that every single time. Right? I guarantee that 99% of people that fish a blowback rig fish it with a hook link somewhere between 5.5 inch and 8 inch. Straight away, there's something you can do different, even with the blowback rig. A 14-inch rig, an 18-inch rig. Have you ever found... 100% know the answer to this before I ask it, but you get a guy on a lake, a syndicate, so everyone knows everyone, everyone knows what fish get caught week in, week out. There's nothing goes undetected, really, so everybody knows all the info every week. Get one guy, it might even be a rare fish, it might be a fish that only normally comes out twice a year, but one guy catches it 3 times and no one else catches it.
Yeah.
You've seen that, right?
Yeah.
So... what I believe that situation is however that guy fishes, maybe he uses 12-inch hook links, maybe he uses 4-inch hook links, right? Maybe he uses snowmans, maybe he uses a stiff link, maybe he uses a pop-up. But whatever it is he does, normally, he's not trying to do anything different. He just fishes how he fishes. Well, that fish feeds in a certain way where that rig snags it. And other people doing their own thing, without being any better or worse than this guy, they just fish in a way that that fish is never going to snag himself on their rig.
Yeah, they're the ones that VR would probably miss. Yeah, I'll tell you. Yeah.
Well, you'd miss the ones that suck from 6 inches away if you use a 4-inch rig. You're never going to catch a fish that sucks all its food inches away.
Yeah, I'm always been about finding the most effective way. You know, when I knew I had that challenging season of hitting Manor and Warmwell, because I'd been on the snake pit and I felt I was out of touch with rigs and I'd popped onto the water and felt, shit, they've moved on. I thought, right, I need to get up to speed. So, like I said, I went back to my benchmark water, Star Lane, for the early spring. And in 6 weeks, I caught 20-20s, which was unbelievable then. That's like, you know, these guys doing it, watching catching the 550s or whatever. And I spent the whole time experimenting, testing, comparing, and talking rigs. This is when I just got on the hand sharpened hooks. And then went on and did the slide shows around the country saying I was having my hook sharpened by a jeweler, and it cost me 50 pence each, and people going, what, is he mad? But I started fishing these hand sharpened hooks, and the first thing that struck me was the crazy and bizarre hook holes I was getting. Top of the mouth, size and whatever. Right? I'd never seen hook holes like that. So I started shortening the hook links down. And then a massive revelation hit me that I was hooking fish in the mouth rather than around the lips. You know, up until then, we always caught fish around the lips.
When they moved away.
And so I always thought that's a faster bait win. But suddenly I'm catching them right deep in the mouth. And so I started shortening the hook link down until I got in my mind, which I still believe to this day, the ultimate hook hold in the bottom lip. I didn't want it in the sides because I didn't want the hook link going around the scissor and possibly cutting into it. You know, that's why I use only 25-pound thick hook links, because I don't want to cut into that. I've seen the damage that does. But I kept reducing it down until I was nailing the bottom lip, and the same thing was 1 to 2 inches back.
Yeah.
Right? So it's all started with, the super sharp hooks, as though sucking them in, were catching them without them straightening the hook link to the lead and tension. That was a big revelation to me. They didn't have to pull the hook in with tension. If the hook was sticky sharp, as I used to say, they would just get caught on, So I then worked on that, because I realised my hook links were too long. I shortened them down until I was nailing them bottom lip, 1 to 2 inches back. And that's how I come up with a hook link length of 9 to 9.5 inches.
You think that's the optimal?
That's the optimal
hook for the majority of carp.
That's the optimal hook link length if you want to nail everything. Yeah. And when, I've been critical of, again, a certain company in England talking about 4-inch hook links, blah, blah. I tried all that and I found the average weight of my fish dramatically dropped. Except
you're catching smaller fish with shorter hook links. Yeah,
except, there will be situations where they're buried into the mud. But as a general hook link length to work on most waters, it's 9, 9.5 inches. So that's your starting point. Like I say, there'll be situations where you might be fishing a foot of silt, they're bearing into it, and you need a short hook link. But if you use a 4-inch hook link on most waters, you're going to catch a small carp. And surprise, surprise, those anglers who recommend that method, they never caught anything fucking big.
I completely agree with what you're saying. Now I'm going to throw in something that is water dependent, and this is why I think it's really important. If you take the other stuff that we've said, you can devise the best method for wherever you're fishing, dependent on previous current habits. So I went on to Elstow One, which was, you'll know it from back in the day, it had a group of anglers, that very efficient anglers, that fished the same way, very secretively. They didn't like to publicise what they were catching because there was an abnormal stock of 30 and 40 pound carp in, even back in the day. But they all fished the same method. Now, this method was effective and it's hammered other lakes since. And the method they fished, and they fished it because of the structure of the lake. The lake was 40 foot deep all over with clay humps. And these humps were coming up to 10 foot above the water with 40 foot around it. So if you're fishing the 40 foot, you're wasting your time. But you might find a hump that's the size of a bivvy that's coming up to 12 foot, 14 foot, 15 foot. Either way, it's a significant feature. And there might only be one spot in each peg. So much so, these spots had names. These features had their own names. Like there was the Haggler in front of the point. So the Hammered, right? Because there was nowhere else to fish in that peg. If you fished in the point, you had to fish Haggler. You couldn't fish anywhere else. There was nowhere to fish. And it had been so well fished, they knew all the spots. The spots had names. And the way to fish the spots was you'd fish all your rods on that spot, obviously. So with that came a very accurate spotting method, because if your spot didn't land on the spot, it was in 40 foot of water, so it wasn't like it was just spread baiting. You couldn't spread bait, so it borne a degree of very efficient anglers who hammered places like St. John's and stuff afterwards by fishing the same method. They'd put the rod tips so close together, the three rod tips were almost touching on a buzzer bar. They'd have the spaced at the back with the rod tips touching, and that was because they'd put a marker on the spot, they'd cast three rods at the marker, and wherever it landed was where you put the rod. You know, if it landed 4 inches right at the marker, you'd put that one on the right hand side. You'd cast another straight at the marker. If it landed on the marker, that one went in the middle, you know, and then you'd try and put one up the left hand side of it. And then same with the spotting, it was really, really tight. Now, it was an efficient method. All three rods would go at once because they were shoal fish. And the trick was to have rigs made so you could get the rod back on the spot again. As soon as that fish was in the net, you've got another rod going straight back on the spot, because the fish had cleared the spot and move to the next spot, which was quite often the next peg. I remember Martin Clark writing in his book, it took him a while to learn how to brace fish, because by the time you've photographed that fish and put the rod back out, that was it, finished, because the fish had just moved off the spot. And it was just... it wasn't because of any other reason than the lake topography. That was how the lake was, and it lent itself to that. So everyone used to fish hemp and pellet and corn. When I went on there, I was told you wouldn't catch on a boilie. First thing, twice that's been said to me, Yateley and Elstow One, you won't catch a fish on a boilie. So I'm only using boilie. That's me sticking two fingers up to everyone that said, you ain't going to catch the way you normally fish. That won't work on here, mate. I'm like, every time someone said that to me, that's the only method I'm going to use.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because firstly, no one else is
floaters
doing it.
Floaters don't work here, mate.
That's another good one. Yeah. Floaters don't work in France. I've heard that a few times. So, first of all, I want to do it to prove a point because I'm an arsehole. And secondly, I want to do it because I know that carp do things that everyone else says they don't. Like, if everyone else is fishing fake corn, I know I'm going to outfish them on a boilie because no one's fishing a boilie, and that's how carp work. So, I also realised that their method was, and it, don't get me wrong, their method's efficient. There's a lot of anglers off there that've hammered to the highest degree other lakes.
Because now it's not an edge anymore.
No, but it's still a skill to be able to put three rods on a dustbin lid.
But because they've all been caught, it's not an edge anymore.
No.
It was an edge when it was first done.
It was an edge when it was done, now, but it still takes a degree of...
Okay, so some of you are better at it.
I'm saying, if I told the man down the street, this is how you're going to catch fish out of St. John's, put three rods as tight as you can, don't land a spod more than 4 foot off the spot, and put 50 spods on it, and keep everything tight and accurate, right? He probably can't do it, because these guys have been doing it for 20 years.
I don't know where this is going, Jamie, but why this is relevant to me is that they are still all doing the same, yeah?
Yeah.
Whereas I have a mate who has caught 8 carp in the last 2 weeks.
Hmm.
from that lake, and they don't even know about it, and they've caught nothing. On an entirely new method, which I can't say on this program.
Okay.
Obviously, I've got respect for what he's doing. I'll tell you when you switch it off in a minute, it's going to blow you away. But this goes back to what I'm saying. You know,
I'm going to have to pause it now because you're killing me.
Are you pausing it?
No, but you tell me in a minute.
But this is my point. You know, what they was doing was great, but now they're fishing like everyone else.
Yeah,
they haven't moved on.
It works on other lakes because,
I'm talking about Elstow. Yeah. They're still mainly fishing that way, and it hasn't moved on. I have a mate who is approaching it an entirely different way. Conditions the last 2 weeks have been the worst all winter. Yeah. He's had 8 carp out there.
Yeah. So the point was, is they fished an extremely efficient method that does work on other lakes, right? The ability, even if I told you the method, your average guy is not going to be able to physically put 3 rods on a hairpin, put 50 spods on that same hairpin, and fish efficiently for 3 days without one spot going wayward. It concentrates a group of fish. It works on well-stocked lakes, and it concentrates a group of fish on a very tight area. And it's a devastating method, and it still works for the people that can do it efficiently. So I went on there with the boilie approach, having been told that's how everyone else fishes. I understood why it works, because we're fishing small spots in deep water, and it's the fish you've got nowhere else to feed without going forward onto zigs and stuff, which is how I would approach that lake now. I'd use adjustable zigs in the open water where they're not expecting to get caught, because they're not expecting, they only get caught off them spots. If they want to eat, that's where they go, onto them anyway. But I thought, hang on a minute, everybody used hemp and pellet and fish corn. That was the method, fake corn, hemp and pellet. So I thought, these fish are not lifting. Hemp's very light, corn's very light, pellet's very light. They're hoovering. Their lips probably don't come up. When they're on these tight spots, these guys were putting a bucket of bait in a day over these 3 rods in a very tight area. These fish are not moving. So using a long rig, they're never tightening to the lead.
No.
So I figured I want the shortest rig I can possibly get. So I use a stick when I cast out. I use like a mesh stick. I compress it with anything, soil, ground bait, stick mix, whatever. The point is it's to stretch the hook bait out so it doesn't land on top of the lead. And it never tangles when you cast it. That's the reason why I use it, other than attraction. So I thought, I want the shortest rig I can get possible. You got to use a hook link clip, obviously, to clip the hook bait on. I'm going to do that. And I was using 2-3-inch rigs and then probably an inch of metal work with the clip.
Mm.
And I hammered it. I had 26 fish. I think the next guy had had 6 fish at the time. Now, I was fishing hardcore every week. I'm not saying I'm better than everyone else, or it wasn't an ego thing. It was just I worked out the most efficient way, and I was catching on boilies and not on, because they weren't moving around for the
food.
That's
so interesting.
I want to, the optimum hook link length is 9.5 inches, but I said that there's various situations.
Well, the situation dictated different, because the fish have been trained for 15 years to hoover.
But what am I going to say? And I put my hand up. I was probably vocal at least 2-3 times in print about the effectiveness of short hook links.
Mm.
And another thing that has never proven effective to me in all the comparisons, one rod against another, was a bait tight to the hook. Just wouldn't do it.
Mm.
I've always believed in separation. I've always said it's 1/2 inch. And then me and Alan went on to the big pit, and massive challenge was in there, finding them, getting them to get onto bait, because the place was so incredibly rich with prawns, shrimp, brackish, blah, blah. And then we're getting done in terms of, we got towels out of the water, shallow water over our baits, we're not getting pickups. And I honestly believe I would not have sussed this water. It was Alan, because of his more open mind, dare I say naivety, But the method on the big pit is a 4-inch hook link on hard gravel with the bait tight to the hook.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, gobsmacked. Anyway, and it's lethal. Yeah. And I think the reason is because the shrimps live under stones. And so those carp, you know, we couldn't catch them over silt. We only caught them over the hardest gravel areas, you know, which on a normal lake wouldn't be rich at all because all the food had been the silt.
Yeah.
But on this water, you know, brackish water, the main food source was the shrimp, yeah, they weren't in the silt. They were actually hiding under all the stones. And so, you know, my take on it is carp are lifting and burying through those stones to find the shrimp that are underneath. Mm. And that's why that short hook link with the bait tied to the hook worked. You know? And so, yeah, the point I want to make is that I, through my life, have found these methods that will catch a majority of waters, and I've gone in the print saying that's the only way to fish. And other anglers will go on and find their methods and go into print and saying that's the only way to fish. And so, you know, the newcomer, whatever, reading these articles is thinking, what the fuck? You know, who's right?
Yeah. Everyone's right, though.
Because everyone's right, because, you know, good anglers find the method.
Yeah.
What I now put my hand up and say is that I now understand there is no one way.
No.
And that's the interesting thing about carp fishing. There is so many different dimensions that fall into it. You know, you can't read one guy's article and think, right, I'll take that to my water and rip it apart. Because it might be entirely wrong for your water. None of us have the answer to everywhere.
It's going back to what we said about naivety sometimes, where the nod comes down and catches the biggest fish.
Yeah.
He's doing what he does without knowing any different, but it happens to be right for that lake at that time on that day.
Exactly.
And a good example of that is Daryl Peck on Yateley. Daryl was young at the time. He had a method that worked on his previous lake, and that was using 20 mil boilies straight out of the bag. Now, when he went on Yateley, they were not feeding the carp. They were using 20 grains of hemp with a shaved down tiger knot on the tiniest hook they could. And they'd gone really anal about these carp are super wary and tricky. In reality, the carp were starving. Like, they weren't getting any food. And you got a load of 40-pounders and 250s in a lake, and no one was feeding them. Daryl was putting 3 kilo of 20 millies straight, a Scopex squid, straight out the bag, and fishing the 20 mil and the size hook, size 6, straight out the bag, and he had half the stock of the lake in 1 year. Now, that was naivety. His method was what they wanted at that time. Right, don't get me wrong, Daryl's a great angler. But
same thing with Collingbrook. Yeah. All those guys down there, for whatever reason, Lee Jackson and Paul.
Tiny bags of bread, we flake.
Before that, they believed it was a single hook bait in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
You know, those fish had never been given bait. You know, Terry turned up, filled it in and caught, and so did Shelley.
Shelley.
Yeah.
You know, Shelley was on it.
In there and out in minutes. And the irony of it was that they went, after they showed them the way, they just carried on fishing.
They're doing it their own way.
And then Lee went on to, liquidised bread.
That's what he called liquidised.
He got the result, but God's sake, where are you going with that?
Right spot in the right time, obviously, and Lee's caught fish from all over the place, so, you know, not doubting that, but Shelley was the best example.
I'm to tell you about Elstow. Can we switch it off?
Let's pause one sec. Feels like I'm in love. I love hearing Kevin talk. I know he's been on the show quite a lot recently. He actually texted me today saying that he wants to come back. I'm booked in to interview him again early May.
try and get one where we're not drinking and stuff. Just try and get. He's got stuff he wants to talk about. He's said that there's a few technical things he wants to chat about. So I love getting into his mind. Some people call me a brown nose because we like Kevin, but he's a top guy, and I think there's a lot to be learned from him.
Oh, definitely is. And well, when we look at our stats, he's a popular guest as well. So
yeah,
definitely bring him on again.
Like he's in the top three most listened to podcasts are extremely close to each other, aren't they? And he's in that top three. So, you know, they're literally a few hundred apart, a few hundred listens. We mentioned the other week we did just under 35,000 downloads in March. We're set to smash that in April. I don't know if you've looked at the figures this week, Mark.
I've had a quick look at the graph. I've not actually added the figures up because obviously all of the stats are not in one place. We've got Libsyn, we've got SoundCloud, and then that's the ones we count.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And I've done a bit of Googling. It's all over the place at the minute. There's millions of little pod sites that have got our podcast on it. I don't know where they get it, but there are loads.
Yeah, I just don't know how many of those stats actually go back to Libsyn.
No, I have no idea. I mean, we can only track, when we count our figures, we only track the two main sites, which is Libsyn, which does iTunes, and SoundCloud. Everything else is just extra. We don't really add them in. Anyway, have we had some listeners' questions this week?
Ask us a question.
Yeah, we have. We've got one here from Scott Palmer. I think this is going to spark a bit of a debate. You skimmed over bobbins the other week. Could you go more in depth into what the best users for all types of bobbins are and their best uses?
I didn't think I skimmed over it. I think I kind of...
Well, you plugged the Avid ones you've got.
And yes.
We didn't go into too much depth. I mean, when this question came through, I was actually playing around in my garage getting my gear ready, and I've actually got four complete full sets of bobbins at the minute.
Yeah.
Three hangers and one set of springers.
Yep, I've got multiple sets of bobbins. The point, right, so basically, unless you're fishing, right, let's take a lake that everybody knows. Well, even if you don't know this lake, the Essex Manor, right? The Essex Manor is about 7 or 8 acres. It's a rectangle. It's deep. Not much weed because it's reed-lined. It's very deep, like, you know, double figures plus. Everywhere, even like just out, because it's deep, there's not much weed. It's like a clay pit, it is, and it's like you're not casting far, you're casting like the middles, 40 yards or something, right? Maybe 45, 50, certainly shortish. So, as you would gather, you're fishing to the middle or less, so you're never fishing more than 40, 50 yards out, you're fishing into deep water with not much weed. So, like, how do you want to present your line? Well, the best way is to try and like get your line on the bottom. A lot of people use fluorocarbon on there, like X line and stuff. So that is an extremely singular type of fishing, right? So if you're doing three seasons on there trying to catch all the big fish, you probably only need one type of bobbin. You probably only need, like, you can probably use a very heavy X line or fluorocarbon to sink to the bottom, right? Because you never need to cast 90 yards. So you can use something very specific to that lake as your equipment, from bobbins to rods to the line, you know, all the kind of important stuff. You can tailor it to the lake. Now, most people haven't got that luxury. I mean, you take a lake like we used to fish, St. Ives Lagoon, right? There's little intimate pegs in corners. There's long chuck pegs between the island where you need to get 130, 140 yards to that. You know, remember that recess on one of the islands that you fished from
Fattest Point? Yeah.
Yeah. There were open water swims. There was island swims. There was corner swims. Intimate, right? So you're not going to have three, four sets of equipment, are you, to fish that lake? You need a set. And this goes the same for most lakes that I've fished. You know, there's all different types of fishing, so you need, and maybe you don't only fish one lake all year. Maybe you fish day ticket waters and you fish 10 different lakes a year, and you fish 10 different pegs on 10 different lakes. That's an exaggeration, but do you know what I mean? You need a set of kit that can kind of cover 70% of situations, I would say. you know, and when you buy gear, that's what I do. That's why we've talked about the P-Line extrusion. I think it's a good all-round line. There are better lines for different circumstances, but for general use, use the 0.35 mil P-Line extrusion. You can cast 100, 120 yards with a 4-ounce lead straight through without a leader. It sinks really nice. There's little stretch so you can lead around in it. It's just a good all-round line. There are better casting lines, there are better sinking lines, there are thicker, more abrasion resistant lines, but we're not going to carry three spools of lines for one lake, because you might fish three different types of peg on the one lake, right? So that's the way I look at my fishing. If I was fishing a specific circumstance, I would tailor that equipment to that lake, such as the Essex Manor, where like there's no long chuck on, like every peg is pretty much the same. Obviously you've got the corner pegs, but you know, one setup will do everything. So the reason why we spoke about the Avid bobbins the other week is because it comes with everything you need. It comes with two different weights, comes with a long chain, a short chain, a long head, a short like the main body of the thing. It comes with a long one, a short one. They're fluorescent colours, so they're really bright in low light conditions. And it comes with two different types of head, one for fishing slack line, you know, like the L-stove type of bobbins, where you can actually lock the line in a clip, which means you can fish the bobbin tight to your reel, but slack in front of the bobbin. It comes with a head that does that, and it comes with a normal head, which is like a running thing. So I say that is a bobbin that covers almost all circumstances. I had a tweet today, actually about an hour ago, of some guy saying he's just bought the Avid bobbins, as indicated or directed by me on the Carpcast, and you are right, they do everything a bobbin could ever need from a bobbin. So that's why I recommended them, that's why I liked them. I do have a set of them. I have a number of set of bobbins. I've had every type of Nash bobbin since they came out. I mean, I used to love the old ones, you know, with like the two metal balls on the head. I had red ones, like quite a big heavy body, and they used to come on a heavy chain, or like an actual chain, like a bike chain. You remember those?
I do remember those, yes. And
they were fantastic because they don't blow side to side, because it's a chain, they only go up and down. A lot of the foreign anglers use them when I've been abroad. You know, like a lot of them are fishing boats at long range, and they want a real sturdy heavy bobbin. They swear by them on the continent in Europe. I did hear a story Nash were bringing them back at some point. But anyway, like the Stow bobbins, a lot of people have bought the Stow bobbins because of the fantastic job that Corda do with marketing. Now, as you and I both know, the El Stow bobbins were made for a very specific circumstance, and that was very similar to what I've just described with the Essex Manor. Deep water, very deep water, it's, you know, 20-30 foot deep, the majority of Elstow, and fishing slack lines with no weed into heavy water for, you know, for pressured shoal fish. That's how everybody used to fish. And they, somebody on the lake whose name you probably know, Mark, kind of designed these, and everybody on Elstow used to use these bobbins. Danny Fairbrass, when he got an Elstow ticket, he saw these bobbins, really liked them, bought a license to make them, produce them, and did a fantastic job marketing them. And now I see people using these bobbins all over the country. They must have sold millions of them. Great, you know, victim of fashion. They're a nice, cool looking bobbin. They're quite a unique design, different to anything else, but they were designed for fishing slack lines. They are not an all-round bobbin. You cannot use them for all circumstances. You know, as I said, use, you know, fishing at 80-100 yards range, you want a nice heavy free running bobbin. Now if you get a decent liner with those Elstows, it pings out the clip, your bobbin drops on the deck, and you've no idea what's happened. Have I just had a tightener? Is there a fish like moving off? Have I just had a liner? Like, what's happened?
2 o'clock in the morning when it's drizzling, you've got to get it back out and reset everything.
Exactly, and you don't know if you've just had a bite, if you've had a liner, because it's pulled up tight on a chain that's like 3 inches long. It's pulled up tight, it's pinged out of that clip that's on the hanger, and you're left there going, have I just had a bite? like, you know, as we know, not every carp screams off and spins a reel. You know, quite a lot of the time they just tighten up these days. So you can have a liner, when the bobbin hits the top, it pings out the clip, and it would have, on a normal free running bobbin, it would have just dropped back down nice and slowly, settled in exactly the same spot it started in, and you know 100% that was a you know, when everything settled back to its original position, that was a liner. Not singling out the Stoles. The Stoles are a fantastic bobbin. They do look really smart, and the use that they were invented for is brilliant. They're probably the best bobbin on the market for that exact use. But they are not an all-round bobbin. So going back to what I said about different lakes, you want a bobbin that can cover everything. Short range fishing, so you can get it nice and slack. If you're fishing, you know, little spots in the edge. Long range fishing, so that, you know, you can get that kind of nice heavy bobbin, get a nice bounce when you pull your line back, fish your lines fairly tight so that you get good indication at long range. And everything in between, you know, medium weights. You need to, I mean, the other thing is where you hang your bobbin. There's this craze of using these 3-inch chains because they look smart hanging off your buzz bars. And
do they look smart though? I don't think they do. I think they're impractical.
They are impractical, good, yeah.
Heavy drop.
Exactly. You need a drop for indication. So when you've only got a 3-inch chain and your bobbins are really close to the buzzer, basically, if you've ever used like butt indicators and stuff for, you know, like coarse fishing, remember you used to use them old like butt indicators that look like a swing tip but go kind of just in front of the reel handle.
Oh, we are getting old-fashioned now.
Well, the closer your hanger is to your buzzer, the less sensitive it is. So on the people that are using these 3-inch chains and having them right in front of... it's physics, right? So if you picture, like, let's say the distance between your reel, where the line comes off the reel, and your alarm, let's say that distance is 2 foot. In old money, sorry to all you youngsters that are metric only now, but we're old. So let's say it's 2 foot from the reel to the bobbin, right? The most accurate place for indication for your bobbin, you know, the most sensitive your bobbin's going to be, is exactly halfway between the two. So that would be at the 1 foot mark, and you would have like a 45 degree angle of your line coming down from the buzzer to your hanger, and then 45 degrees going back up to the reel. Now you play with that, you set it like that, which is impossible to do with the 3-inch chain. That's my first point. Now, if it's really windy and you're getting a few false beeps, what you used to do was to slide the hanger forward and put it the closer to the alarm it goes, the less sensitive it is. I remember Gary Bayes telling me that. And showing me, you know, it's like say other styles of fishing, they know that if it's windy, you put it closer, and you know, and it's annoying getting false indication, you put it closer to the buzzer. It's just physics. So this craze of having everything really tight up to the buzzer and reel hand is folded and rods close together, all this like really compact look, it's fashion over function. You know, you should have a long distance between your backrest and your front rest, the longer the better. You want as much as the rod in there as possible. You want a decent drop on the hanger, and ideally you want the hanger halfway between the reel and the buzzer, and the further distance the reel is away from the buzzer, the better for sensitivity. You ever test any indication, that's basically how it works. So I do have a bee in my bonnet about fashion over function. We have mentioned this quite a lot, haven't we? And carp fishing has gone very tarty, and I'm all against things looking cool, but I like, you know, I like the things to do what it says on the tin. You know, I want the most indication possible. We're going to catch more fish by knowing more what's going on underwater. You know, we want to know if we've been done. If you sat there and you got, let's, whatever the indication is on your hanger, if you get done just on dark, right, but you don't know you've been done because maybe you're using a hanger that's just pinged out the clip, and you sat there going, oh, do I need to recast my rod or not? Well, let's say you've been done and just dropped in a little weed bed. If your indication haven't told you that, you've just wasted a night's fishing. Your rod's going to sit out all night. You reel it in the morning. It's in weed. You're thinking, well, I didn't think I landed it in weed. Whatever. Oh, never mind. I blanked. You might have just been done on dark. If your indication had told you exactly what had happened, you might have realised you'd been done, reeled it in, put a new bait on, chucked it out again, and had the chance of getting another bite. But if your indication is set up in a way that looks good but doesn't really give you the full picture, it's going to cost you fish, and you might not even know it. So, are we going deep on bobbins? Is this deep enough, do you think?
No, I think we should carry on, because there is a few other points. We've not even mentioned spring arms yet. That's a bit of a dividing subject, as we found out recently.
Yes. Yep. Springer arms, they obviously pull back they pull back against the resistance. So I don't think springer arms, you could ever use them all round. I think they're absolutely perfect for zig rig fishing, because of the distance. If you're fishing an 8 foot zig, like that, you've got 8 foot between where the fish picks the bait up and the lead. So when they first pick it up, it's going to move the lead slightly. It's going to lift it up an inch or two or whatever. Now, that usually results in a drop back, just because, again, the laws of physics, as soon as that lead lifts up, you get a couple of beeps drop back. So generally, when you're zig fishing, you get any downward movement of the hanger, you've got to hit it straight away, because 99% of the time there's a fish on. So a springer arm accentuates that. It will take up any slack instantly, because a springer arm is going to give you the most amount of indication. Now, I watched the Fox video. I think it was that was it the Fox Edges one. 44 minutes in, anyway, they do a test on long range fishing. Rob Hughes swims out. And he dives, and they use a slack line, they use a normal kind of drop with just the weight of the bobbin, and then they use a springer arm, and they test all of them on the same spot of range, see how far that he can move the lead. He was moving the lead like 3 or 4 rod lengths without any indication on the slack line. Slack line fishing, any more than a few rod lengths out, you're just wasting your time. If you don't believe me, you can watch this video. It's one of the Fox DVDs. We'll maybe find it and post it on the page. It's certainly, I've already posted it in the thread where we're discussing springer arms that Paul Bacon has posted on the Carpcast page. I've already posted that video and put a timestamp where this bit is. There's more indication on the like semi-slack bobbin. There's definitely more indication than the slack line. But it's still not fantastic. And then the springer arm, it does appear to show quite a lot of indication. They only move it like a couple of feet, and there's indication. But the way the indication works is, I only noticed this on the second or third thingy, the way they have it set up, they have the line in a clip by the reel, like a line clip on the rod. Yeah. They have the line in that, then they have a very tight line, with the springer arm obviously keeping it tight. What happened when they moved it, the springer arm, because of the resistance, actually pulled the line out the clip. But once the line was out the clip, the indication didn't seem to be great. So unless you actually fish with a clip, which I don't, I don't think the springer arm is the most effective indication for long range fishing. I actually think the way myself and Paul Bacon, which he brought up in that post on our page, I actually think the way we fish is the most accurate way, and that is by fishing a very tight line but with a free running bobbin and a heavy weight. So you want the heaviest bobbin you can possibly get, or as much weight on it as you can possibly get. I'll tell you what, the old what were the Fox arms you used to be able to get? What are they called?
They're all swingers.
The Fox swinger arms. They were great for long range fishing. You had a weight that you could slide up and down the arm, put it right to the end where the line clip was. They work really well. I'm really happy with my long range indication. I always have been, and Roger Bacon or Paul, as he is on Facebook, if you look for the thread. He is too, and he does a lot of long range fishing, 100 yards plus fishing up to snags on far margins. And you know, these, the fish that we catch on the particular lake I'm thinking about, they're never snagged, and it's very snaggy over there. If you're not on the rod straight away, it's going to find a snag. So I believe we're getting the indication early enough before the, you know, the fish is definitely not kited a rod length before we get indication.
Yeah, I'm going to butt in now. I was using stringers a lot last year for long range fishing, and using a line clip, as I always do anyway, I was getting exactly the indication you described and catching fish because of it. Yeah, I was also fishing a locked up reel, and all I was getting for them, yeah, was two or three bleeps, the line's tight, pulled out the clip, that's all I needed.
And just pings out the clip, yeah. Yeah,
that I is agree, all but you needed. And like, kind of, hang on. I'm going to butt in again here.
Did you never have a liner do that, though?
No. Not once. Yeah, it's not a venue where you get many liners, to be honest. They're either on you when you're catching them, or they're not.
This is my point about the stow bobbins, though. Like, you want something that resets itself. Like, if you're relying on the clip and a springer arm, it can't reset itself.
Well, it does reset itself. It's pulling back. The only difference between the pullback of a heavy bobbin and a spring arm is... The higher up the spring arm gets, it pulls back more. The lower it is less.
Yeah, and which doesn't react very well to liners. I was with Dave on Cromwell, and Dave was using his spring arms. He's been using them for all his fishing, and he was fishing in peg 8, fishing like 80 yards, and we were on fish. We were getting quite a lot of liners, and then the bobbins were just acting really weird. We couldn't tell if it was a liner, a bite. Like, it was definitely not the same as just using a normal bobbin. You know, for general fishing, again, I think the springer arms have a purpose. Maybe fishing at extreme range where you're not going to get much indication anyway, maybe they are perfect, you know, like as far, literally as far as you can cast, 140s, 150s, fish them in a clip, like you said, when it pings out a clip you hit it, but because you're probably not going to get much indication on a liner at that range anyway. But I would not recommend them for fishing 80 yards.
No, I'd say, I don't know, you know, 70 and less now. But even for long range, I'm torn between hangers. The only reason I'm not using hangers at the minute is because they're brittle. I keep breaking them. Well, that is a drawback of them. But I have been doing, well, like I said, heavy bobbins and, well, those curves that GRC do that we reviewed a while back. You've got the arm, which combats the wind, and you've got a nice long change in two heavy weights, and that's my choice at the minute anyway.
But that's my one, when we did the true review on the avid bobbins, that's my one criticism, is I don't think the weights are heavy enough that come with it for long range fishing. But I think, you know, most people don't fish over 100 yards. For anything up to like 80 yards fishing, there's everything you need in that kit: the long chain, the short chain, the two different types of head, the two different types of body, and two extra spare weights to go on it. So again, they will cover 70 to 80% of your fishing. I would maybe, if I fished one lake that was long range and the rest of it was normal, I'd be happy using the avid bobbins for 80% of the time, and then just have an extra set of very heavy bobbins for when I fish, you know, the long range lake. If you never fish a long range lake, no problem. They're useful for 100% of your fishing. I mentioned on last week's, or a couple of carp casts ago, when we spoke about the bobbins, that I'd seen the new Nash ones that were coming out. I saw something on the net today, actually, that they have actually been released. They're like the old slap heads. Remember them white slap heads that they did?
Yeah, I've still got a set.
Yeah, they're like a new improved version of those. They're like black, and they also do an arm, like the swingers that we've just been talking about. I really like the look of them. My problem is, as I've said about functionality, there's four different sizes of heads. Like, the big one looks really big and heavy. I think it's like 40 gram or something. And you can add extra weights on them. But I haven't seen them yet, so I'm saying this off the top of my head from there. I saw a promotional DVD from today that's just gone up on the official Nash Tackle page. But the problem is to cover all aspects of fishing, you're probably going to need to buy two or three of the heads, I think. And the arms, I don't know if they come in a kit. This is why I'm going to reserve my judgment till I've actually seen the package. But I would want the arm, the long chain, the short chain, and all the different size heads. Now, that's probably going to cost an arm and a leg, I would guess. I don't think that like each one's going to come with all that. I think you're going to buy, you know, the chain that you want, the head that you want, or the swinger arm that you want. I mean, if you had it all, it will cover every situation, but I very much doubt all comes in one pack. And this is my criticism. I know everybody says I always kiss the arse of Kevin Nash and all their products, but I always say how it is. If there's something brilliant, I use it. And I use, as you know, 90% of my tackle is Nash. But looking at these hangers, I think that you would have to spend a hell of a lot of money to have stuff that covered all situations. And that's my thing in carp fishing. We need something that covers the majority of situations you're going to encounter. Yes, specialised situations call for specialised bits of equipment. You know, if you fish extreme range or you're fishing somewhere like the Manor where you specifically want to use X-line and you know, get your line on the bottom. But I think the majority of stuff we do is all round. You know, we need it to cover the majority of common situations.
Yeah, and just to be different, what do you think of the balls I was using at Cromwell?
Yeah, they look different. They were like round hangers with a head on them. What make are they?
Corum.
Yeah, quite like the look of them, actually. And again, as we spoke about, you know, functionality over fashion, they were extremely bright. And, you know, I noticed your bobbins and my bobbins as the light was getting really low. You know, they were still extremely clear to see. Yeah, I liked them.
I do like those. You get in the pack, I don't know where they are now, somewhere lost in my garage, but you get like four different colour balls. I was using the red ones, but I think you get white, green, and a glow-in-the-dark one. So if you know, charge it up with a quick camera flash, you'll see a bobbin all night.
Wow. I think we've ranted on quite enough. I think we've gone into sufficient depth about bobbins, haven't we?
We have, yeah. There's no type we've missed out. All the washing up liquid bottle tops or
too light
monkey climbers.
Yeah, I've still... Oh, I'll tell you what I found today, actually. I found my original Fox Swingers, the Mark 1s. I found my Optonic sensor heads, which were the ones that had a wire permanently. Yeah, I cleaned out an attic and I found a load of my old gear. I found two of them original bait runners, you know, the very first Shimano bait runners, like 19.
Oh, the one with the excellent line lay.
Yeah, yeah. That's what I thought. And I looked at it, the spools look tiny. It's probably 1985, they are. Anybody
were they like sea spins or something like that?
Something like that. They were actually called bait runners. Anyway, yeah, anybody collects old carp gear and wants to make me an offer, then my converted sounder box with a GPO speaker, the on and off switch, the two Optonic, they were the latching sensor heads that had first ones to have a latching light on them for when you got a beep. I found it all in an attic. I was binning everything. I was like, I can't get rid of them.
No, don't. It might be worth something in another 20 years.
Yeah. Do you want to tell us what's in this week's Carp Talk?
I will. I'm just going to scroll down on my notes. I was just getting so carried away with bobbins, but news. Here we go. It's been a busy week again. Everywhere's kicking off, like you said. And little Mike Wilson from Nash, he's gets front cover. 240s, including Stella from the Essex Manor. In his second session.
I wonder what bobbins he was using.
I don't know. Was he testing the new Nash ones? There's a possibility, but... You know, I thought Stella's been 50, hasn't it?
Yeah,
I did notice the Northern Lenny was well down in weight recently as well, down like low 40s. Who knows? But yeah, 250s from the same Lincolnshire water, a 54 and a quarter pound late record from a Cambridgeshire pit. They're getting very cryptic again. Mm-hmm. And three different 47 pounders from Horton Church Lake.
Yeah, but one of my friends, Deke, shout out to Deke, Mike Deakin. He, this week, last year, he had a mega session or two sessions on Horton where he had an absolute hat full, including a load of the 40s. He's done the same thing again this week on there, except the fish are just bigger. He's had fish up to 48, which obviously the fish are getting bigger in Horton. What a fantastic lake that is again. Again these days, yeah, but yeah, I doubt that's in this week's carp talk because he's only just caught them, but I'm sure it'll be in next week's.
Yeah, I think it was a week or two ago now. Dave Levy had a brace of 40s on a day session on there.
I saw it, yeah, I saw that.
Yeah. Quality angler. There's more news, we've not finished. Rob Hughes announces his Carp Team England squad for the 2016 World Championship title defence.
Yes, we know all about that. Obviously, we've just had Rob on. Carp Talk have the exclusive in today. Well, you're listening to this on Saturday, assuming you download it straight away. And as we know, the Carp Talk digital version comes out on a Saturday. You can get the news first there before the printed edition comes on a Tuesday. All you keenies can get it on a Saturday, be the first one to hear all the latest news, and the digital version only costs £1.49. It's available from pocketmags.com. You can download it to your Apple iPhone, iPad, your Android phone, your computers, all from pocketmags.com, and it's cheaper than the printed version, which is normally out on a Tuesday. And like I say, they've got the exclusive on Rob Hughes. Just like we have today, if you're listening to this on Saturday. And there's going to be a bit of England news pretty regularly over the next week, so you need to keep your eye out for that. But there's also news in Carp Talk of the first ever ladies match between England and Wales at Barston, the full lowdown on that. And all the usual features in there. Tom Makers in there puts together a haul of carp from Linear Fisheries Brazen Host 2. Get the mag to find out how he's done that. Simon Bates is in there explaining the best, how to get the best out of overnighters. And loads of catch reports from the opening week of the season on RK Leisure's most iconic waters, including Raysbury. And something you'll like this week, Mark.
It's another competition that I'll fully intend on entering, but not get round to it. There's a load of signet baiting poles, baiting spoons, baiting spoon floats up for grabs. Fill your boots.
Fill your boots. Get this week's Carp Talk. Every single Saturday you can get the online version, pocketmags.com, only £1.49, and get the printed version from your normal Carp Talk stockist. There is a list of stockists on the Carp Talk website, which will be in the show notes underneath if you just click on the link. And you can just go to your normal news agents and get them to order it for you. That's the easiest way to do it. And the printed version comes every Tuesday. Right, it's been a long one this, Mark. I think we can turn it in now.
Yeah, I think it is. I've got a few things myself to do this evening. First one is drain the bladder because I'm sat here cross-legged. Second one is I've got a load of new bait today, so that's got to join. Got to get put in the freezer.
Green bait.
I hope not. No, it's some real good carp bait. I'm really looking forward to using it because obviously, you know, always going to new bait's a bit of a leap of faith, isn't it? So,
yeah. Yeah, definitely. Well, hopefully we'll have fishy stories. Next week's show is the end of the month show, so we'll induct somebody else to the CCIWOF, the Carpcast Internet Wall of Fame. We'll be inducting somebody next week. Hope you've enjoyed this show. If you do want to support this show in any way whatsoever, there's loads of ways you can do that on our website, www.thecarpcast.com. www.thecarpcast.com. There's merchandise on there, hats, hoodies, t-shirts. You can buy episodes of the Carpcast Extra. You could subscribe to it for £35 a year. You can buy knowledge DVDs on there. You can just register an account to get our newsletter, which is completely free, or you can listen to all the back episodes of the Carpcast at carpcast.com. That's it. We'll see you next week.
See you next time.
Check out the website at www.thecarpcast.com. There you'll find extra content, merchandise, and lots more to support the show, including our entire back catalogue of free offerings.